So this is what I'd like to do. Even though the NIH was in total denial till about 5 years ago that technology had anything to do with effective science, I'd like to review a little bit of the technology of neuroscience and just sort of just sketch a couple of things. You know, people asked early on about like noise constraints and electrodes, this and that. It's worth understanding a couple of these stories. Patch electrodes, there's this huge competition around the world. You know, all these you know, middle-aged, you know, modestly well-known scientists trying to figure out how to suck on a piece of glass. I mean, there must have been something going on here, right? So it's worth understanding what's happening. And then I think more a little more recently, there's actually again sort of been this influence of trying to probe things not by directly, you know, sort of high impedance measurements, so not by directly putting wires in things, but using some external signal. So there's been a lot of talk about extracellular voltages. So you're using the fact that the neuron has some finite size, some non-zero size, zero still being finite. So there's extracellular currents, but also starting, you know, what was about 25 years ago, or 30 years ago, there were already hints that the optical properties of cells will change depending on their activity, or you could actually augment this by adding various contrast agents to augment this. Most of this work, I sort of put on who the principals were because people ask about references, and this is I think this is a continuing area. By sort of looking at a distance, should ask one more. This is a continuing area where people will add probes, okay, to individual neurons and use those probes as contrast agents to look at voltage or look at intracellular ions. Okay, calcium is a particularly popular one, but it's sort of at the point where people look at other ions like even sodium or things like cyclic GMP or cyclic AMP, etc. Okay, and so I realize most people are theorists, but I think it's worth seeing where the field is going in general. So it started off with a lot of heavy work trying to understand how to measure voltages and how to build servo mechanisms to control the voltage in individual cells. This was sort of the voltage clamp of Kenneth Cole. If you're a chemist, you would say potentiostat, right? It's all the same words, right? I think where things are sort of going today is on the one hand, there was there was sort of this clever idea due to Marvin Minsky to do optical sectioning with confocal microscopy, which I'll sketch very briefly, but there was an even more clever idea due to Winfried Denck when he was a graduate student in Webb Lab, which is to get nonlinear absorption in tissue and therefore do optical sectioning. And this is, you know, for the first time sort of allowed people to look on one organism at depth. Right, maybe hundreds of microns below the surface, and track optical changes. Okay, then you need a contrast agent. So I mentioned that there's a number of agents that over time people have added to cells. Larry Cohn started this business of voltage sensitive contrast agents. Larry Cohn also started the calcium imaging business, although it was rapidly taken over by Roger Chen. As in business, the early innovator, you know, gets the candy bar. But what's happening now did this sort of very interesting observation that there are hydra actually, or jellyfish that glow green. Okay, there's sort of this revolution that started up where people can get proteins that express that actually fluoresce. Okay, it's actually a cute story to tell because I love to take stabs at the NIH, right? And but sort of the flavor now is that you can get individuals by making the right transgenic animal, you can link a protein that fluoresces, okay, to the expression of any other protein. You don't even have to make a fusion protein. So you could have, let's say you express CAM kinase and at the same time you express whatever, protein X, you also express this fluorescent protein at the same time. So all of a sudden your cell starts to glow green or yellow or red. And it used to be that in order to watch for a certain protein coming up during development, you had to take the animal, right, drop it in liquid nitrogen, cut it up like prosciutto, and look. And I think what's happened now is that there's this combination of optics techniques that came from physics and the sort of combination of fluorescent indicators that comes from genetics, that you could just follow, you know, the expression of a single protein in a cell, right, and follow it in the same animal, so you could get the temporal sequence. So it's actually sort of technically, it's a fun time, and from the point of view of development, it's a fun time. And what's beginning to happen, but hasn't happened yet, is to make animals that have a genetically expressible functional indicator, right? That's like one of the I'm sort of an Old Testament kind of guy, but I guess it's one of the holy grails out there, right? And so that is, you know, many clever people in strong labs are sort of pushing in that direction. It's likely that that will happen. It's likely that, you know, 15 years ago, if you wanted to get a restriction enzyme, you had to contact somebody's lab and they'd isolated it from the right bug and they'd send you a little tiny vial. And today, you know, you just sort of pop open the Sigma catalog and you buy a restriction enzyme, and it's likely that, you know, in a dozen years, you'll pop open the Jackson, you know, animal catalog, and you'll say, okay, I want this mouse that expresses this indicator. Da da da. It's there's going to be a lot of glow in the dark animals running around. Okay. So anyway, the green fluorescent protein story is an interesting one. It's just sort of as a warm-up act. So this was a fellow who was at Woods Hole in the Oceanography Institute, Chatterley, and he had been studying jellyfish, right? And he was curious why jellyfish tended to glow green while, you know, all the dianoflagellates and the little hydra that express luciferin and luciferase are glowing blue. Right, so he got to the point where he had isolated a protein, and then from the protein he had worked his way backwards, found the message, and actually had the gene, okay, for what we now call green fluorescent protein. And the panel turned down his grant, right, saying that this was completely uninteresting because, you know, who cared about a protein in a hydra, right? And he was really on his last legs, soft money position at Woods Hole. I mean, it's a beautiful place, but, you know, kid got to eat. And he did the thing that normally no biologist would ever do. He gave up his clone, and he gave it to two labs. And he did two things. He gave up his clone, and on the other hand, he had just enough money to try to express not the whole thing, but a piece of it, right? And he guessed wrong. Okay, so, and I'll show you a picture of green fluorescent protein later, but ultimately the protein was crystallized by a lab in Columbia. It was a modification of it was crystallized in Roger Chen's lab in San Diego. And it turns out this is a protein that looks like Chinese handcuffs that just winds around in beta sheets and then has a little center, fluorescent center. And it also turned out after, of course, people expressed it and crystallized it and realized it was so robust, there's an entire industry, right? There are companies like CloneTech up in San Francisco, which probably get 95% of their income from green fluorescent derivatives now. So sort of a whole industry was created, and this has become, you know, I mean, as from a genetic point of view, probably the most singularly important tool, right? Grant turned down by the NIH, right? Because it wasn't interesting. So anyway, so hopefully he'll get the Nobel Prize for this, just to stick it to the NIH, and hopefully. But I think it's important, you know, it's a lesson. If you think you have something interesting, you should just push, right? It was sort of a fascinating protein. It's also very interesting because there's, you know, a huge number of people who claim they know everything about protein folding, and no one predicted this protein. No one could even predict the fact that it would fold and autocatalytically form a ring. And one of Roger's students had a thesis defense recently, and it was actually a lot of fun because they, you know, people tried to take this protein and modify it, so it reduces its sensitivity to things like pH, you know, changes in charge on the surface. And, you know, he said, oh yeah, you know, we tried, we talked to lots of theorists, we got lots of rational advice around protein folding. No rational scheme was successful, and therefore we just went ahead and used sort of combinatoric schemes and screened. So it's a tremendous challenge out there for a theoretical chemist, right? Total failure so far. Okay, on that note, let me just go back and just back up completely and just talk a little bit about noise issues in voltage. So early on, somebody asked about electrodes. Like, let's say, how do you do an experiment? Okay, so there's a lot of equipment involved, obviously. You need a little microscope to look under. You need a place to chop up your preparation. You need another place to pull glass to make electrodes. But at some level, you need to understand sort of noise issues, right? And I just want to sketch a couple of fundamental noise issues. And everything always gets back to one thing, either looking at the Johnson noise in a given measurement scenario, and the Johnson, the reason you have Johnson noise, again, just to remind you, is you have a resistor and it's closed, and you say no, you know, where's the battery, right? No current can flow, but because we have a finite number of electrons, okay, that at any given time, right, something, if we have sort of n charge carriers at any given time, sort of the square root of n are sloshing in one direction versus the other. So because of that, there'll be a fluctuating current. And if the fluctuating current to this resistor, and if I look at the voltage drop, okay, if I was actually to hook this up and do a high impedance measurement, and look at the voltage drop, okay, I have an out of equilibrium pool of electrons. It's trying to build up a potential. Of course, the potential becomes self-limiting, right? So I'll look at a noise which is going all over the place. Okay, so it's that noise, right, due to this resistance, okay, that you always have to beat. I mean, that's the essential principle. And this noise itself gets back to these kind of square root of n fluctuations, okay? And I'll sketch some of these various optical techniques. Again, it's a little bit of this sort of WYSIWYG kind of view. And then, but again, it's at the end of the day, it's always this square root of n that you have to beat. Okay, this afternoon, Rick Buxton will come and talk about functional magnetic resonance imaging. Again, it's a beautiful story of somebody worrying about the noise. That's how it was discovered. And again, the minimum volume has to do with, you know, trying to beat the thermal fluctuations of sort of the square root of n spins in a small volume. Yeah.
Is that why a shot noise approach or a picture is not the right way to look at things? Or does it come in? I mean,
well,
he mentioned square root of n, but I don't think a constant noise that way. I think that's a shot noise.
I guess, okay. I mean, on the one hand, maybe I may not have the deepest appreciation of this, quite seriously. So, I mean, on the one end, on the one side, there are always kind of square root of n effects. So I think of Johnson noise, you have something dissipative, right? So you have a fluctuation, the fluctuation that is quenched by the dissipation. Okay. And so I think of sort of dissipating elements look like that. But then if you think of a thermal light source, right, where the number of photons come off, that clearly gives you a shot effect. Okay, because if you have sort of noisy stream of light coming at you, and then you detect it, you just detect that noise. So I think more shot effects in these optical measurements. If there's a better way to look at it, I'm seriously open. Is it? Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's not noise that way. The temperature is right?
Yeah. Okay, I mean, let me see if I understand right. Just to write, well, let's see, because I usually, let's see, how do we think of doing that? We think of, in Johnson noise, we have a, energy distribution, which is it's the phonon distribution, right? It's e to the. Okay, so I had to expand this. I had to look at how do I want to look at this? Yeah, but then I'm going to expand this, and I'm going to get h bar omega over kt. So I'm going to get a kt. Okay, so then this looks like power. So the power will go like kt, and there's a factor of 4, which I've is not in this, times the bandwidth, right? Times over our resistance. And is this what we want? How do you get, I don't see how you get n out of this.
You don't, that's my
point. Yeah. Okay, but then I don't see why you think of this as a shot noise.
No, I don't. I said, I'm thinking which is further than effects, but I don't see how that and Johnson noise are really that closely
the resistance, just.
The energy fluctuation has h squared over r at the r.
Let's just think a second. This is a voltage. This is a current. This is obviously a voltage. All right, let me think about how to do this. All right. All right. Let me think about how to do it. I think you have to scale out that the resistance goes like 1 over charge density. Let me think about this for a second. Okay. All right. That being said. All right. So what we want to do is just, we kind of want to remember Mr. Nyquist. Okay. And this is basically the idea of the voltage equivalent to this, as we talked about earlier, is 4KTR. Delta nu. Okay, so let's see what happens. Let's just remember, we have a cell, right? And we started out the first day by asking about voltage levels in the cell, and we kind of argued that just due to the free energy cost, right, the chemical potential, that what it costs to move an ion from the inside to the outside looks like kT of the sort of the log of the number of carriers, right? But it was sort of a thermal energy kT scaled by some small number, logarithm. Okay, and we also talked about the lowest level, which was the noise level in these systems. And we kind of convinced ourselves we basically had to evaluate this expression, okay, which was 4KTR times the bandwidth. And what does the bandwidth mean? Well, if we look at the distribution of sort of thermal modes in a solid, it's flat and finally breaks off in the infrared, right? This is just a sort of IR. Okay, this is frequency, but we're actually cutting it off early, right? So it's essentially flat. Okay, and so this is our bandwidth. But you know, we know if we have just a low pass filter. Okay, a low-pass filter is just a break. So an RC filter would give us something like this. Okay, so within, you know, numerical factors of like, you know, pi over 2 or something order 1, okay, then this bandwidth, okay, is just going to be something like 1 over RC. So this just gives us a cute little expression. Okay, and it just really depends on the thermal energy and the capacitance. Capacitance is just a statement of geometry. Right, dielectric constant, area of the cell over the thickness of the cell. Right, so some of the noise just depends on the geometry. So really, this is a model of a cell where we have a resistor and we have a capacitor. Right, if we hooked up a neon light bulb, we would turn this into an integrating fire neuron. Okay. So now we just have to think about our electrode for a second, right? And just ask what the constraint is. So now we put an electrode in here, and let's see what's happening. So, So at the first, it's true it's glass, and it's true it's tapered, and lots of things are true. But rather than make up a disgusting and icky complicated bottle of the electrode, it's just, you can think of it, there's some resistance, and the bottleneck of the resistance is, well, at the bottleneck of the electrode, at the tip of the electrode, right? And there's some capacitance of the electrode to ground. Okay, so again, the electrode has an access resistance. And this is going to cost us a noise, right? So this guy, so if this is Rm, and this is Cm, and this is Rm, and this is Cm, and this is Rm, and this is Cm, then that's Re, and this is Ce. So there's going to be a noise here, and it's going to be exactly the same kind of expression, 4kT R of the electrode times the bandwidth. Okay, and okay, so now all you have to do is say, I just have to design my electrode, all right? So this resistance, okay, gives me a Johnson noise to make a big enough hole, right, that the resistance of the electrode is small enough that I could beat the noise of a cell, okay? But you could even go one step further, right, because you could ask kind of what the... You don't care about signal, okay? I got to be careful. You care about signal only in the sense that the amplifier down the line, okay, may have sort of technical noise sources, okay. But let's say you have perfect amplifiers for the moment. Then the only thing you really care about is signal to noise, right? Noise, you know, to say for an experimentalist to stand up here and say the signal is small is an absolutely meaningless statement. It's all signal to noise, okay. That's the only thing that matters, okay. So the signal we have to beat is this guy. Okay, this gets us down to the noise floor of the cell. But then let's look at this guy. Okay, you see, again, if I want to capture all the information going, all the information in the cell gets quenched at frequencies higher than the bandwidth, right? So optimally, I'm matching the bandwidth of the electrode either equals or exceeds that of the cell, right? So very crudely, then I could write the same thing. I could just write this. I'll say, all right, the bandwidth of the electrode is also 1 over RC. So this looks like the electrode capacitance. So this just looks like C of the electrode over 4KT. And it's very simple. The total capacitance of the electrode, okay, somehow has to exceed the total capacitance of the membrane. And then you win. Okay. So at the end of the day, you get sort of a simple expression. And in fact, you know, usually you pull the glass to such thin scales that this is not a problem. Okay. So I'm just saying again, you could put in a bandwidth, which is on the order of whatever it is for a cell, maybe 10,000 hertz. Okay, in order to beat what's going on in the cell. But if you just look at the ratio of these two terms, okay, you want to make sure that the noise of the electrode is smaller than equal to the noise floor of the cell. So it's really just a statement of balancing. It's a geometrical statement. It's a statement of balancing capacitances. Okay, so this is one sort of simple example. So let's go on to a little bit of a more interesting example, and that's the example of the patch electrode. Okay, so I'm going to do a kind of similar thing here, but I'm just going to change the geometry a second. Okay, so in the patch experiment, people were really interested not in measuring a voltage, but they're interested in measuring a current. And we had to understand why. It's because we had currents that were functions of voltage. So what we really wanted to do is to see voltage fluctuations versus time. So a way to think about this experiment is here's your cell. Right? And now what I'm going to do is, this is really one of life's modern miracles. You could take a piece of glass, you can pull it, right, and polish the ends, right, and then just press it against the cell and just right, sit there. It's all these sort of semi-pornographic noises coming out of people doing patch experiments. And then the glass will actually seal against the membrane of the cell. Okay. No one knows why it happens. It's great. But I think what people realized early on from noise measurements, and we talked about channel noise, is that you have single cell currents that are on the order of about 10 to the minus 12 amps, okay, and that's what's going on. Okay, so let's see why people worried so much. You know, if you read the literature, it's interesting. People talk about this thing called gigaseals, right? And let's see where this number comes from. Okay, so again, we have a Johnson noise just written there. Goes like 4 kT bandwidth. Okay, over this resistance. Okay, so you can see immediately that the scaling is such that I need to have my resistance kind of large enough, right, in order to beat the in order that I had to have this resistance large enough so that this noise is small enough so I could see currents of about this size. Okay, so we can just put in a couple of numbers here, and let's see if we could do it. So I could just turn this around. So sort of a signal to noise of 1, right? I need a resistance that looks like 4 kT times the bandwidth over this current squared, and I'm going to just divide by E and multiply by E, because I know what this is. This is 100 millivolts. All right, so this is 10 to the minus 1 volts. Oh, bandwidth is kind of the bandwidth you would guess to make an estimate is sort of the rise time of the action potential, right? So this might be something like 10 to the 4 inverse seconds. That takes care of this guy. The charge of the electron is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. And then we said we needed I, which was about 10 to the minus 12 amps squared. So coulombs per second, that gives me an amp. Okay, volts per amp gives me ohms. What's the chance of doing the algebra right? This is 10 to the 3, 10 to the minus 16 plus 24. This is 10 to the 8 ohms. Is that right? Okay. So you kind of see what happened. I mean, there was this notion that you had this seal had to be bigger than about, for signal to noise of 1, right? It had to be bigger than about 10, about 100 megohms, right? Now, what is a signal to noise of 1? This is actually one of these fun concepts. You can't see a signal to noise of 1 by eye. Okay? So signal to noise of 1 means that you have, here's say a current, and this is time. Okay, so that's my raw data. Okay, so that's like the 1 sigma point, right? So that means if I go above this line, right, roughly 1/3, right, 2/3 of the total, plus or minus sigma is 2/3 of the stuff. So 1/3, so it's like this. Okay, it's that line. Okay, so a signal to noise of 1 would be to say that this thing shifted by that amount. If I just showed this to you, you'd be hard-pressed to say. Right, so then there is the famous Shelley-Schultz rule. Okay, the Shelley-Schultz rule said that to do statistics by eye, you need 5 sigma. And the reason is that it's cute. It's one of these psychophysical things, right? That if you just draw a little band here, right, you tend to go about, somewhere between 2 and 3 sigma, right? So this is about 2.5 sigma. Just try it. Make up some random noise, right, and just give it to somebody and have them make little lines. This is like one of these things, like you're in the lab trying to gauge signal to noise, right? So then if the signal shifts, right, by this amount, right, everybody who says that looks good, right? And that kind of gives you a chi by I, you know, as the joke goes in this numerical analysis book, right, of signal to noise of 1. But it's really signal to noise of 5, because everything you do is in terms of RMS, okay? So when you think about it, for the signal to noise to go up by a factor of 5, this guy is squared, right? So that means the resistance has to go up by a factor of 25, right? So basically, we're sort of talking, you know, in this sort of signal to noise order 1 by the Schultz rule, right? We need something that looks like about 10 to the 9 ohms, okay? And that's sort of the origin of this problem of trying to make patches with sort of gigohms, you know, the gigaseal, okay? So there's an interesting bit of sociology here because this stuff came up in the very early 80s, and I was in graduate school when this was done, and I remember visiting. Just there was a lab upstairs from me when people were doing this, and they would take all these amazing compositions of glass and pull them, or they would take glass and coat them in ovens with pure silica, you know, pure quartz. So they tried pure quartz and they'd polish them. There's all this amazing lore, and finally it got down that there was this one kind of glass that you used to do volumetric titrations at the microliter scale that became the lore of the patch glass, and the war stayed, because in 84 I took a neurobiology course, and you know, people would like open their little, it was like, you know, the way people would open their little stash of marijuana, people would open their little stash of pipettes, right, and give you one, and you had to, you know, respect this pipette, you'd pull it. And somehow, you know, 10 years later, it's, you know, any piece of glass, pull it, and it works. It's kind of funny. It's one of these things that once the first person does it, all of a sudden, a couple years later, everybody in the world can do this. Okay, but this is a very simple thing, but basically this kind of technology allow people to make measurements on single channels. Okay, and probably the greatest practitioner today of this is a guy named Fred Sigworth at Yale, who was a graduate student, was a postdoc with Bert Sackman. Okay, and obviously people go to other lengths, you know, to increase the bandwidth. Just sort of a little glib about this. They'll often coat the pipettes, make the glass thick, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so there's kind of been a lot of technology to try to automate the electronics, but the essential point is again this issue of Johnson noise. Okay. Okay, I'm still thinking about N. I think it has to do with the number of charts. This guy goes like, you get a current, because this goes like, the resistance goes like 1 over the number of charge carriers, right? So this looks like a current. So this is where you pick up the square root of N, but you still have a KT. Not happy, okay. All right. Okay, I think, is there anything more anybody wants to know about intercellular recording? I could move on. Okay. Okay, so let me spend a couple of minutes about extracellular recording, and particularly the measurements of field potentials. We've seen a lot of data where people will show spike trains, okay? And where is that fellow who doubted the extracellular recordings? Where'd he go? Didn't wake up. Ha, scared. Okay. There's this total intellectual embarrassment in this business of recording, and is that if you have a brain and you have an electrode in the brain, okay, and people talk about looking at the signals that come out of here, and they talk about things that are called like the local field potential. Okay, and you know, so talk about extracellular recording, and if you look at the spectral density of this as a function of frequency, it does a couple of things. One thing it does is it completely diverges at low frequencies, and that's okay. So this is intellectual embarrassment number one. then it sort of falls off, then it has a little rise again at high frequencies. So this might be kind of 10 to the 3, 10 to the 2, 10 to the 1 hertz. Completely cuts off at high frequencies. OK, this stuff here will end up sort of being the spikes. You kind of see where it comes from. The rise time is about 10 to the minus 4 seconds. It's a sharp edge, right? OK, and the width is about a millisecond, right? And then, you know, it's bumps transform into bumps, right? So you get a bump in time, you get a bump in frequency, right? It's the bump theorem, OK? So it's one thing to say, OK, I'm very close to a cell, and I look at, and I just record these high frequency signals, and I interpret them as spikes, and then I sort them accordingly. But the low frequency stuff is actually difficult to interpret because nobody's actually measured the impedance as a function of frequency in cortex. This is a fine project for a young scientist who wants to come to the lab. Okay, but there is sort of a way around it, which I'm just going to sketch because it's common in the literature. And this is this thing called current source density. Okay, so the sort of the notion is that I haven't defined this, okay, but what I could do is, in fact, is come in with two electrodes that are spaced a distance apart, and you sort of have to do this self-consistently. You have to convince yourself that the electrodes are close enough that there's still some substantial correlation between these two electrodes. Or they're actually, the way I'm going to talk about this, we're going to need three electrodes. Okay, and what's going on? Let's see. So what we really are after is sort of the divergence of the current, and the reason we're after that is because we want to know, okay, if there's a like a synaptic input, which means charge is being is entering the cell or being excluded from the cell at this point, right? So this. This, of course, is just the change in the minus the change in the charge density with respect to time by the continuity theorem. So let's just ask what that is. What we remember is that J is just the conductance times times the electric field. Okay, and we also remember that this is a tensor. And we also know that the voltage, this is just the gradient of the measured potential. Okay, so sort of very ugly. Okay, but so where does this first intellectual embarrassment that we don't know this? Okay, another. I mean, this gets an unhappy face and a tear. Okay, so we don't know this. We don't know this conductance very well, either as a function of space or certainly as a function of frequency. Okay. Nonetheless, as true scientists, we plow on in the face of ignorance. Okay. And what we could then write is that this thing, which I call the current source density, this divergence of J, is I'm just going to assume that this is equal to a constant. Okay. And this becomes div grad. So this is just the Laplacian of the measured voltage. Okay. And this means, okay, if you remember that this is, Laplacian looks like this, right? So it's really defined by 3 points, right? So this corresponds with it's two derivatives, so it corresponds with 3-point measurement. So basically, if you measure from 3 points, very common kind of measurement. What you're doing is you're asking is current coming out of this point, which means is charge being created or is charge being destroyed? Okay, now obviously if I integrate over time, I better not be creating charge or it's like Repo Man, right? One of you will just explode. But it's a way to define this. Let me just show you what one of these looks like. Okay, there's a fellow from my lab here, Kurt Ahrens, who uses this all the time. So I'm just dwelling on this because Well, I'm just trying to show you where the holes are in the field, and also it's just worth understanding. So in fact, yeah.
I'm a little bit behind. Why do I get a Laplace in just 3 points? It seems like 1 meter.
So yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. No. Okay. I apologize. I'm just as a tech. You're absolutely right. As a technical issue, I should go in with a matrix of 27 points, right? Three times three, right? And define a region. There's a push in that direction by a group at the University of Michigan using sort of silicon-based probes. In practice. Okay, it's a fair point. In practice, one usually calculates this current flow only in a given direction. Okay, so it's 3 points. And I'm sorry, I didn't maintain my notation. Okay, now the reason. Okay, so why do it only in 3 points? And I think that it's applicable if there's a special axis picked out in cortex. Okay, so the most successful of these measurements. Probably the most successful of these measurements were done in hippocampus, and I'll just show you a sketch. If I could show you a sketch, if I could find. Okay, most of these were done by a fellow named Yuri Buzaki, and I think the point is that you have laminated structures. Okay, and if you have one in hippocampus, there's. You could actually make a slice, and it doesn't look so different than the picture I'm drawing. Okay, and they have all the usual Latin names: layer pyramidalis. Okay, layer of the cell bodies, layer of the dendrites on top, layer of the dendrites on the bottom. When you translate it, okay. But because of this, there's a sense of current flow along a line. So it's a reasonable question to ask is. What's the timing of the synaptic input coming into these upper branches, right? These so-called apical dendrites, relative to the timing coming into the lower branches. Okay, so therefore you can go in with a sea of electrodes. Okay, and you may even go in with ones that have very very many wires. Okay, and just record this current source density as a function of position. Okay, but it's incomplete information, but you're sort of putting in by hand the fact that things are probably translationally invariant because there's this kind of one-dimensional structure to the system. Okay, if you did this in a invertebrate ganglion, it would probably be a useless measurement, right? Because there's no sense of direction. Okay, if you did this in cerebral cortex, it's useful to the extent that you do have an axis, right, of cell bodies having dendrites and axons, at least dendrites, right, the primary dendrites running along what people in physiology, this is called the radial axis, right, it's whatever is normal to the tangent, and things do tend to run along that axis, and that's why you get by with this, okay. Okay, and I mean, the reason that this is, I'm just dwelling on this, I think more, there's a number of reasons why local potentials, why the local field potential is kind of coming up again in popularity. It's sort of like Sebastian said, things go in and out of fashion, right, like culottes and capris. But what happens is that, work in a number of labs. I mean, one particularly nice body of work is by this fellow Bijan Pissarin and Richard Anderson's lab in Caltech is, you know, show that at least if you look in the right frequency band, there's aspects of this field potential which give you very nice receptive fields. So it turns out it's a much more robust signal than trying to record from spikes. So as people try to move towards prosthetics, you know, to try to get signals that give you intended motor position, it's going to become more and more important. And just to kind of see this, so this particular data was taken on turtle, and it's not important, but you could put in probes with very many sites, up to 16 these days. They're made of silicon. Everything has its price. I mean, this is kind of like, you know, going with a butcher knife and saying, okay, I didn't perturb the person, you know. People get arrested in other fields for doing things that you do to animals. But I think what happens is that you record these voltages, they're very ugly, all the signals look alike. By the time you take a second derivative, just to look here, you could see this is the second derivative, spatial derivative of the potential versus time, and this is time. And you can just, as you look at different depths, so effectively you're moving from here to here, what you see is sort of a signal flip, okay? And all it's saying is that this is a place in the cell where current is rushing in, and this is a place where current is rushing out, right? So you could play these kind of games to give you feelings for where different dendritic inputs are. Okay, so in some people's hands, this has worked well. Okay, I could give you references. My favorite guy is Lou Haberle, who's done this in the olfactory system. Okay, so I think the lesson here is you can stick a wire in the brain and you can measure field potentials. What's not known from single wire measurements is what the radius is. You don't know the radius because you haven't characterized the impedance, right? You haven't characterized the lossy part and the dissipative part. I mean, the capacitive part. You know, I think from a theoretical point of view, it's also interesting. And let me just show one more picture. Okay, so bear with me for a moment. Okay, so this is data from Yuri Buzaki's lab. Probably makes the finest extracellular measurements. This is the only measurement made in the entire world in which somebody's had an intracellular electrode and an extracellular electrode in the same cell, okay? Stud, okay? You see the spike go off? Okay, this is just a derivative. You know, you're pretty much dominated by the rising phase, all right? You know, D by DT, okay? You can get some feeling, I drew on the board this kind of spectrum, but you can get some feeling the spikes are sort of these very small, fast events, you know, riding on this background. That's why they spectrally separate. That's why people will report data as local field potential, which means everything in here, versus stuff they use to sort spikes, which is everything in there. So that's sort of a flavor. So I just want to emphasize this impedance issue a little bit. I think it gets washed over. This is from Victoria Brattenberg's lab. He has a little book called The Textures of the Brain, where he's stained individual cells. Just from an artistic point of view, it's spectacular. And you look at this and you go, great. It's like Fantastic Voyage. I just go swimming and every soul is like swimming in sand. Every soul is like swimming in seaweed, right? It's a picture, it's a notion you get from this. I'm just, you know, every so often I'll just bonk into a cell, right, and sort of flutter around it and then bonk into another cell. But, of course, the way that picture was taken is by going in and filling a single cell with a dye molecule that fills it and doesn't fill any of the neighbors, right? And then you took a picture which is only, you know, sensitive to this dye. So you only see one cell. But I think this is the real challenge. Theoretical challenge, too, because it's so tortuous, okay? So in fact, it's like, you know, it's not a swimming pool, right? It's tortuous, as you would say, and you have these thin little extracellular spaces. So every time, you know, somebody like myself says, "Oh," and then the remodeled cell is going to ground. Okay, and you think of ground as this, you know, bath. It's not. It's this tortuous space. So there's serious open theoretical problem to try to calculate what the impedance of such a tortuous media would be, and this serious open experimental issue to characterize this. And there's literally one useful paper in the whole world that was published on this in the cerebellum, where there's a lamina structure. It's a nice paper. But if you want to interpret these multidimensional signals, this is needed. Okay, so I'm trying to shed a problem. Okay, but I think you just have to remember all these models about single cells and everything else. This stuff is packed. Okay, this stuff is like you packed it and then you sat on your suitcase. You have something big like Omar, sit on your suitcase and pack everything in, and you've really minimized the space. And it's sort of amazing that the crosstalk is not any larger than it is. Okay, yeah.
Maybe that's a trigger question, but why do you need to put the air into the tissue and not outside?
What?
Why do you need to put the air into the tissue, the reference electrode, and not anywhere else, for example, in a piece of paper?
You mean when you're making a measurement?
Yeah.
Okay, so the issue becomes the following. What you'd like as a reference is somehow the average, right, of all this interstitial space. Okay, so the way you usually do that is you make an electrode which is measuring, which has a defined point, right? So it's insulated up to a point, right? And then at that point it conducts, all right? And I didn't even talk about the conduction issue, because metals use electrons and tissue uses ions, right? So you got to do something to go from electrons to ions, but you did all that, right? But then, in order to get a reference, you take the same wire and you just literally strip off a lot of insulation. So you're averaging over this entire region, and then what you're trying to do is effectively make many contacts with this interstitial space. Okay. Now you could say, no, why not just take the electrode and just stick it, put someplace in the animal, like put it in the back of the neck or in the gut, and that's fine if an animal is anesthetized, but if it's moving around, then the muscles have potentials, right? So you can't go too far away, because you got a whole animal, right? And you have to think about the potentials due to the heart, the muscles, other areas of the brain, right? So in some sense, you'd like to measure at a point relative to some spatial average of the potential. And you achieve that with this very gross electrode. Gross electrode. Right, against the average, right. No, I mean, it's actually not a trivial question to get the grounding right. I mean, that's usually where people, you know, lose it, is with grounding. Okay, any other? Now, if it went by 1/F, you'd get a rat which would occasionally hit a megavolt, and that would be, nobody would go into this field, it'd be dangerous. I wasn't kidding. It's an embarrassment. So there are some very low frequencies in the brain that run around in tens of a hertz. And as I'll describe a little later with respect to imaging, the dominant noise source in all of these techniques is motion of the muscles in the vasculature at 0.1 hertz, right? So you see these low frequency things, but it gets progressively harder to make measurements at low frequency. So there's been very little motivation. I mean, you walk into the room, right? If you want to go down at a 0.01 hertz. That means you know, if you walk in the room, you move the charge distribution around, and you influence your recording. People just haven't done it. I'm trying to talk a little bit more about what's not known, and when you finally think about it, it's embarrassing. I mean, but okay, it just hasn't been done. Okay, so okay, anything more on electrical stuff? Any questions? Anybody have any questions on anything electrical in any cell? Okay, so let's move on to something more fun.
When you see the best place to stick the electron in, I mean, it's whether the dendrites are, the axons, or the...
Oh. What do you want to measure? The voltage?
Yes, anything, for example.
Okay, to measure the local field potential, that's a good point. So, I don't have data to show. I didn't bring data to show, but most of the slow currents are connected with synaptic inputs. Okay, so the largest local field potentials are usually in places dominated by dendrites. So in some places like hippocampus slice, that's easy to define. Okay, in places like cortex, it's not so easy to define. Okay, to measure the voltage in a cell, so let me just show you another picture, second. All right, so this is, this is just out of a catalog. These are these pipettes. I mean, I hope you could get some feeling. So the thing that this is going to be a patch pipette. You have a tip that's about a micron. So let me just give you a feeling for the state of the art. Larry Abbott just alluded to this. I mean, if you wanted to measure the intracellular potential, okay, I think it's, I mean, it's true. I mean, what Larry said is true. People debate whether the intracellular potential is largest a little bit into the axon or the density of sodium channels. The density of sodium channels, the density is the greatest, not the numbers, but the density is the greatest, or in the soma. But if you measure in the soma, it's a pretty good bet you'll get your largest signal. Okay, now if it's somebody in the audience who studies insects, they'll say, of course, this is wrong. But they're a minority, so we'll ignore them. They're not protected by equal opportunity in California. Okay. On the other hand, if you measure off in the dendrite, these were beautiful experiments done by Greg Stewart in Sacklin's lab, then you could also measure active signals, right? But they're typically much smaller. Okay, so that's okay.
There's a distinguish between the dendrites, I mean, to distinguish whether the locative potentials are generated before the synapses or after that?
Yeah, okay, so that, not electrically, but to do that, you have to do this with pharmacology. So if you think it's presynaptic, what you could do is you'd have to break synaptic transmission. Okay, so let me just give an example. Okay, so now, okay, so this used to be the hippocampus, right? Okay, so just because I know there was data taken here, right? I've now transformed it into the piriform or olfactory cortex. And you could kind of do this because there's a huge fiber tract that comes in, right? This is the lateral olfactory tract, right? And then you could be, I'm just sort of sketching what's data behaviorally, right? So you could actually be measuring at depth and just to understand what fraction of your signal is direct stimulation of the lateral olfactory tract, as opposed to what signal are actually coming in by this series of association fibers, right? You can go in and just block synaptic transmission. So you need drugs that basically block something like excitatory transmission, block glutamate, right? So they have funny names, you know, CNQX, doesn't really matter, right? You need drugs, right? You want to know the origin of signals, you need to do drugs. Okay. Okay, so I think that's, again, there's various fancy things that people have done, but let me just give a sketch of what's coming on in terms of voltage-based signals. Okay, so I just prepared a little summary here. You got to be a little careful not to. There are people who worry about sort of pushing this technology of diary recording, and there are people who kind of use it. Okay, I'm primarily a user. Okay, there's still quite a lot of open physics here. So let me just sketch in words a couple of things, and I'll show some key data, and then the sort of second part of this morning we'll go through various experiments. Okay, so I mean one thing that happened was early on it was realized that when an action potential goes through the cell to a squid axon. Okay, this gets back to primarily the experiments of Sir Keynes, and Bertil Hilly and Larry Cohn were postdocs in his laboratory. It was a very, very rich intellectually. And you had this squid axon, right? You know, we saw a picture of it before. It's huge. It's a millimeter, right? It's enormous. Right? Every time there's an action potential, It jumps. Okay, there was a cute paper published about 8 years ago. This thing is enormous, right? Someone put a little dot on it, a little dot of gold, built an interferometer, and counted fringe patterns, right? This thing moves. Okay, it moves for a number of reasons. One is that it's the axon is actually surrounded by a little sheath. Okay. So there's another little, let's go back to our friend. There's another little dirty story in neuroscience, right? Half the books start out by talking about the success of the Hodgkin-Huxley model. Okay. It sounds great, but if you look at the voltage versus time, and here's where you stimulate, you turn on a current source here, and you look at the model, it goes, okay, and then you look at the real axon, it goes. So it depends. If I only look at this much, it's a fantastic success story. If I ignore the first spike, it's a complete disaster. Okay? It tends to get left out of the textbooks. Okay? This problem was actually solved by Choi about 4 years ago, published in Jane Neurophysiology, and there's a sheath around the axon. Okay? And in fact, the potassium concentration goes out of balance, and the chemical potential we wrote on the board actually has to be changed. So when you think about the way the squid works, which is whoosh, right, and it jerks, like you watch a, if you ever go to Woods Hole, there's this fancy. I wouldn't crawl on the floor of that place for anything. But there's this bar called the Captain Kidd, and you could look out and you could see all these squid. Right, at first you think maybe you drank too much, but then you realize that you just whoosh, you just see all these jerky movements through the water. So they're basically blasting away once and they stop, right? So behaviorally, all they really need is one spike. It's muscle contraction, okay? But because actually you have this ionic imbalance, you get a little bit of swelling, okay? So this was shown very nicely by Larry Cohn and his student Landon, okay? So what this says and what will happen is that even this basic model applies even at the level of cortex, and you get, with a lot of electrical activity, you get an ion imbalance, and the ion imbalance leads to swelling of the tissue. And I didn't even put it up here, but there was a paper published in 67 by this fellow Bob Galambos that they looked at even the impedance across cortex in cat in response to the electrical activity, and if you think that the thing is really swelling and the optical properties would change, even the impedance changes, right? So sort of four, these were sort of standard two-wire Wheatstone bridge measurements. So I think these kind of things have not been exploited very well on a fast time scale, these sort of changes in scattering, and I think it's a little rich. Okay, so it's a little rich. Okay, so I might show you some of this. Okay, so this is one way to infer neural activity, that the data is what data there is pretty strong, but it hasn't been exploited as a technique. The other issue that has been exploited as a technique, and I'll sketch a little bit of this because it did answer a couple of questions in neuroscience, is this business of adding a contrast agent. So let's see how this could work. Okay, so there's kind of two possible mechanisms, and I'll sketch both. What Larry Cohn, speaking of combinatorial chemistry, so this was the days before of mass screening, but this fellow, Larry Cohn, who's an interesting guy because he invites people for dinner at his house every summer. He's actually a wonderful person, But every summer he invites everybody over to his house for dinner, and he makes people sign a guest book. And I thought, oh, what a great guy, he's keeping track. And then last year I found out that he just goes to the IRS and he says, look, this was a business dinner. This was a business. Very interesting. Okay. So, but what you may remember from just quantum mechanics is that if I look at an energy level, right, I have a molecule. And let me just look at what's called first-order Stark effect. So there's a broken symmetry in the molecule, right? So what's going to happen now is that I could look at the energy of say the ground state as a function of potential, right? So what's I put a field across here, an electric field, right? And I'm going to start to distort, okay, this the molecule, okay? So if I distort the molecule, I'll distort the optical dipole transition, right? In principle, okay? So as a function of potential, this guy will start to distort, okay? And at large enough fields, of course, the distortion will start to go nonlinear. At large enough fields, the molecule will just shear apart, okay? And I could do the same thing for the first excited state, okay? And I could also do this, okay? I'm just going to make him a little weaker, okay? So in the first excited state, obviously the valence of electrons have changed, the charge distribution has changed, and the way the molecule reacts to the external field has shifted. Okay, so if it's true, okay, that this gap at some d not equal to zero, okay, is different than this gap over here at d equals to zero, okay, then the absorption spectrum of this molecule would change. Okay, and the way I've drawn this, actually, the effect of the electric field is to shift this to lower energy. So as a function of wavelength, if I plot the absorption, I have something like this for V equals zero. And then I have something like this for V not equal to zero. Yeah? No, they are not. They are big, right? They're big. They're big. Let's think about this a second, right? Okay. What's the fundamental field, right? I mean, we need. I mean, the Rydberg energy is 13 eV, right?
And where are these quantum gauges located?
What?
Where are they located?
Where? I haven't shown that yet. Wait, let me do one thing at a time. All right. Let me do two things at a time. Okay. Okay. In, out. Right. This is the membrane. Right. So this is a gap of something that's like 15 angstroms. Yeah. But let's think of energies. Right. Binding energies are a couple of EVs, and scales are a couple of angstroms. Right. Right. So we have something on the. We have molecular field. The internal molecular fields are on the order of let's say sort of 10 eV for angstroms, right? Okay, or e over a Bohr radius gives me something like 20 eV per angstrom, right? That sets a fundamental scale. And let's just look at the membrane. So I have something on the order of 10 to the minus 1 volt over something, let's say, like 10 angstroms. Right, so this looks like 10 to the minus 2 electron volts per angstrom. Okay, so it's a factor of 1,000 down, right, from sort of a scale that will rip apart the molecule. Right, but that's already suggesting that, you know, this sounds like, okay, so I don't have to worry about the molecule being ripped apart, but I certainly could think of spectral shifts on the order of a part per 1,000. Okay, now part per 1,000 is to get back to your thing about shot noise. It just means if I probe it with 1,000 squared or 1,000,000 photons, I can have a signal to noise of 1 to look at an absorption change of a part in 1,000. So that's easy, right? That's easy. Okay, does that set a scale? Technically speaking, right. The electric field is large, right? I mean, just to give you a feeling for how large it is, so the fields across the cell normally run between like maybe plus or minus 50 millivolts. That's maybe at most minus 90 to plus, you know, that scale, order 100 millivolts. By the time you actually, if you just do a simple experiment and you put a field across a cell, which is on the order of 200 or 300 millivolts, or a potential across the cell at 200, 300 millivolts, you'll break down the membrane of the cell. So, and I mean, that becomes a technique, right? It's called electroporation. It's a way they sort of get drugs inside cells in culture. You put large, put transient large fields across. So your neurons are actually operating fairly close to their breakdown potential. And I think these kind of bonehead estimates are the realization that you're operating close to breakdown potentials tells you that you know you're suspicious that there could be optical changes. All right, you know it bears on this issue of scattering, which I'll get back to. Okay, so this constitutes one contrast mechanism. Okay. Yeah. Volts per angstrom. Okay. What? Oh. Okay. Sorry. Thank you. Okay. All right. So let me. That sounds good. Okay. So, and let's just see what happens. Okay. So this is. Let me just give you a little sketch, and then I'll get back. So in fact, one can make these molecules. Most of these molecules are made by a fellow named Leslie Lowe in Connecticut, or by Rena Hildesheim in Amiram Greenwald's group and Weissman. And you know, they consist of sort of, there are these, what they call amphipathic molecules, or hermaphroditic molecules, whatever you want to call them. And you know, on the one hand, you want them to get them in the membrane. On the other hand, you have to get them to the membrane, right? And so they have to be a little lipid-loving to go into the membrane, but they have to be a little water-soluble to go into solution. And on the third hand, which brings us back to the first hand, they have to have a permanent dipole moment, so they'll sense the electric field. Okay, so how chemists make these things is totally beyond my ability to understand. But the point is that you get molecules and you get these sort of spectral shifts, you know, sort of as kind of described, sort of maybe part in 100, part in 1,000 kind of shifts. And just to show this, so this is data already back from 1973. It's the first measurement, and I think this was exciting. And this happens to be a pain cell in the leech, and this is 50 millivolt change as measured electrically, all right, by having an electrode in the cell, as I described. And this is a change and this is a measurement done by sitting as follows: is you have to ask where do you sit in these experiments? Okay, well you're really looking at a small shift, so. We're looking here, so obviously you don't sit at the absorption max, okay? You sit at the edge. It's the same issue with receptive fields, right? You have a cell that has its maximum sensitivity to orientation here, right? It peaks. It's actually most sensitive to changes in orientation off on the edge, right? Because that's where you get the greatest variability in rate. So you just sit at the edge when this is done, you see these beautiful changes in the optical signal. So this sort of spawned an industry, and this industry went in two directions. So I'll sketch a little bit of these ideas. Okay, so this is one way to measure this. Okay.
What's the time resolution for these measurements?
Well, in principle, it's as fast as molecular rearrangement under the Stark effect. So you know that's. I know speed of sound in the molecule. I mean, it's kind of whatever that means, and it's infinitely fast on these scales. Okay, I'll get to another measurement that's not infinitely fast. Okay, so this is one, right? I mean the thing I'm trying to get you to think about now is contrast mechanisms, right? Adding stuff to do contrast. Okay, and so the other thing to realize is that when you stick an electrode in a cell, you risk making it's an invasive measurement, right? You risk making a hole in the cell. Okay, or at the very minimum, even if you use a patch electrode, and then the things I didn't talk about, patch electrode is very high resistance. You could argue, oh, nothing leaks, but at the same time, you have this little cell, right? Little itsy bitsy cell, and you have this giant electrode, and you're perfusing out all the guts of the cell, right? So then you change. So you see really stupid papers that are published where someone will say, oh, we patched this cell and we measured no evidence for internal currents to cause this cell to burst. Meanwhile, you've washed out all the calcium buffers. You've washed out everything. You know? I mean, it's no brainer, right? So what people are trying, right, to do in these directions is sort of make the ultimate high impedance measurement, right? Okay, that's kind of the idea. Okay, so this is one kind of mechanism, okay, for which things are sort of at some stable position. There's another kind of mechanism which gets back to our idea about the sort of electrodiffusion equation. Let me try to sketch that. So I could have a molecule that looks like this. It's a little lipid-loving, right? It has a reporter, like a fluorophore on it, so I could detect it, right? Some optical absorption center. And then it has a charge. Okay, so what's going to happen to this guy? Yeah, okay, so you got the idea. Well, one of them is kind of bad, but it's going to partition itself between the two sides of the membrane. So at large times, you know, if the inside is net negative, if the potential here is lower, okay, I'm changing the partitioning of the dye. Okay, so this is a technique that was long exploited very heavily in the field of sort of bioenergetics. Okay, so you would reap. So this was sort of a thermal or Nernstian equilibrium of charge, and it just so happens that your charge was tagged by a fluorophore. The good thing about this, of course, is that you get sort of e-fold change in concentration, okay, for every 25 millivolts. So you could actually, in principle, you could think you could get huge changes. And this was exploited in the world of bioenergetics, and you needed a way. Now, there's no way to look optically and tell the inside from the outside because the membrane is 20 angstroms thick, and the wavelength of light is maybe a fraction of a micron, okay? It's maybe 1,000 angstroms, okay, or a few thousand angstroms. So you need some additional mechanism to report this distribution. So there's two possibilities, okay? One is that when the density is high, you could get something called quenching. Okay, so the two molecules will actually tend to come together and form like a supermolecule, and they'll lose their optical properties. And this gives you a little bit of contrast already. The other possibility, which has sort of been exploited, and I'll show some data because it becomes a powerful technique for finding these neural circuits that people talk about, is coming in with a different fluorophore. And this guy is pinned. Okay, on one side of the membrane. So this is actually kind of cute, okay? Okay, because what's happening now is that if this fluorophore is close, okay, then there's going to be some interaction. Okay, with the energy of this interaction, it's going to go like the dipole moment of one guy, okay, times the electric field falling off of the other guy, okay? But this guy's electric field just looks like his dipole moment over something like RQ plus some other terms, right? So you have an interaction energy which goes like mu dot mu, it's not really important, over R cubed, okay? And then what happens is, to go one more step, you have sort of an energy, a transfer, okay, or an interaction transfer rate, or an interaction which goes like the square of the energy, right? Fermi's golden rule. Okay, so this is going to go something like mu dot mu over R cubed squared. So this is some very 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 fast. This can be very very large at small distances, and it falls off very dramatically. So you have this kind of picture, okay, where I can excite this. Sorry, just go here. I have this fluorophore in the ground state. I could excite it up, it could fluoresce down, or at the same time, it could actually transfer its energy to a neighbor and fluoresce down. So if this is molecular system F, this is molecular system F prime. And this transfer rate goes like 1 over this 6th power of the distance for dipoles, right? And higher powers for quadrupoles and things like that. Okay, so this was due to, this was actually suggested in a calculation by a fellow named Foerster, right? And it became a very, very, again, it became a powerful technique in the biochemistry world. It was, the experiment was first done by Eisenberger, and it was exploited heavily by Stryker, Hubert Stryker, to look at the distance between proteins, tag proteins, on cells. It's more recently, it's become another technique to sense voltage via this mechanism. Okay, so this is mostly the work of Gonzalez and Roger Chen's lab, and you have one molecule, which is like, you're taking a charge, right? The charge really doesn't want to go through the membrane, because the dielectric constant of the membrane is very big. So you have to wait, right? So this, to get back to your question about time, this tends to be slow, okay? So slow means anywhere from 1 second to a millisecond, but certainly not instantaneous on the scale of biology. But once you have this charge recalibration, then you, as a contrast mechanism, okay, you use the fact that the fluorescence of the original molecule can either decay directly or via this intermediate. Okay, so if this energy is lower than this energy, you can just spectrally resolve this. Okay, so this has become, slow as this is, this gives very, very large signals, and I'll show a little bit of data, and this becomes a very nice way to actually find out individual circuits. So I'll sketch through that. Okay, and this okay, that's it. So let me it's not been exploited in that I know of in any useful way. Okay. It's not been exploited in any useful way. Okay. Okay. All right. What do we get out of some of these techniques? So I'm gonna put my focus here. Okay, the first question you could ask is, what could you, we talked early on about propagation and action potentials, and it's a little tricky. It's one thing to measure it in a giant squid axon, but it's hard to measure it in a single cell, right? So how might you measure this in a single cell, particularly a very small cell? So there's been a number of measurements. This particular data is from Dejan Zeskovic. I think it's particularly nice. This is from a helix ganglion. Okay, it's a pretty big cell. There's no scale. This is about 50 microns across, but then the axon itself is only here at something like 5 to 10. It's drawn pretty thick. And I think what's going on here is that you have exactly this first kind of dye, this star kind of dye. So you're looking at a spectral shift, and you asked about the speed. So, I mean, here we are, you know, we're basically sampling here at a couple of kilohertz, okay? So we're capturing the action potential. And what you could see here is very nicely, okay, this is the signal at time zero, and what's reproduced is always in the dark curve is the signal at time zero, okay? And the dotted line is the signal measured at various distances along the axon, right? And I think it's some of the cleanest data for active propagation, because you can sort of see very nicely what the time delays are as a function of position. Okay. Now, this in itself would not be so terribly exciting, okay, if the cell didn't do more, if it didn't somehow do unexpected things by being able to measure from many sites at once. So let me just go on a little bit. This, again, is data from Dan Zeskovic. If you could actually read these little pictures, then you don't need glasses. But this is an interesting cell, because the cell, again, it's from helix, but it's this same flavor of cells you see in cortex with basal and apical dendrites. Okay, here's the soma. There was an action potential that was launched from a nerve root at this end of the preparation. Okay, let's think about a little bit what happened. Okay, this action potential is just cruising along down this cable. Okay, what happens? Okay, what happens? What could happen when it hits the soma? What is the soma? It's higher impedance or lower impedance than the axon? Lower, right? So it could just be, right? Hits the soma. Soma has much lower impedance. It gets shunted out. At the minimum, you might say it'll take a little bit of time to charge the soma up, right? So the soma could have some delay. And then the other thing that's not really obvious is that, look, there's a process on the other side, okay, and it branches. So there's a lot of possibilities, okay? So people ask questions about branch failure, right? You know, Larry talked about these models of Rawl where, you know, you match the sum of the three house powers. I mean, stuff that will never, ever happen in reality, okay? But you get an impedance mismatch, right? At the junction, right? We all know from transmission line theory what happens. You know, you get reflections at a junction if you don't match impedance. So it's actually not, it's one of these things you really have to do the experiment to understand what happens at the junction. So again, this is data from Dan Zeskovic. I think it's quite beautiful single cell data. And so this is just a picture in space, and you can kind of see what's happening. You could look here and you can see on this side of the world, and each of these little boxes is the optical signal as a function of time. And fitting for this optical kind of measurement, you could look at very many sites at the same time. So this is about 500 some odd sites, okay? And you can see two action potentials here. So you notice that something funky is going on already, because I only launched one, okay? And I think you could, if we coarse grain this a little bit, we can just see what's going on. So this is the same data just put into to pseudocolor, right? And what's happening is we have an action potential coming. Action potentials are colored red, and depolarization is colored blue. And I don't know why people think red is hotter than blue, but that's beside the point. It's coming from the side, okay? And this is pretty hyperpolarized. It hits the soma, right? Soma was just blaring bright. The detector itself has a certain dynamic range, right? So there's some technical issues under the rug here. But you can watch it. It starts to depolarize, right, the cell right around the branch point. And it's kind of cool because this depolarization is now starting to leave. But this is what's happened, is that the charging of the soma was so slow that, in fact, the process on this side, on the right side, had a chance to recover, right? The delay was longer than the relative refractory period in that branch. And then the pulse just bounces back, right? So it's playing ping pong, right? So I think this is one of these things that wasn't so obvious. So I thought this is the kind of single cell data you can get from these systems that, in fact, is very special. Okay, so this is what? It's from Helix. I'm ashamed. I'll look it up on the break. Okay. Okay. I think that's a little bit of a flavor at the scale of one cell. So let's just go on and understand a little bit of these techniques in one cell. Okay, so I mentioned again, how can we exploit these kind of techniques at the level of single cells to tell a certain thing? So various people sort of began to talk about circuits, right, and began to talk about the weight matrix, the WIJs in circuits. So we talked very briefly about the central pattern generator. I talked on on Friday about the central pattern generator in Tritonia. Let's keep in mind that was involved. That was two laboratories over 8 years that basically ended up with 12 cells, right? So you want to, so the question is, what kind of technology can you use to poke to measure from various cells? So of course, one could always think of putting pairs of electrodes in, right? And it may sound outrageous, but like in the leech ganglia, there's, depending how you count, there's maybe about 120 cells, 130 cells, and you could think of measuring all possible pairs. Okay, you probably need to do it a couple of times. Okay, Omar's like losing it. Okay, so let's just think of another way in which one can do this. Okay, so I mentioned that it's possible to have dye molecules, as I sketched, and you can make one species which happens to be labeled for O, just flip between the membrane and equilibrate, and another species gets pinned, okay? And as a general search strategy, the problem with electrodes, you're measuring things in pairs, so their scaling is like number of cells in the ganglion squared, okay? What you'd like to do is use a search strategy which at least goes as the number of cells. So you could think of going in to, say, here, okay? This is a leech. This is the ganglia from a leech. Just like in Tritonia, all the cells have labels on them. Okay, and you could think of going into one cell and stimulating it with an electrode. But then, rather than putting an electrode in individual cells, then you could think of driving it and looking and seeing what all the other cells are doing. So again, this is something that comes out of this kind of imaging technique. And this was done. This is the work of Adam Taylor in Bill Cristan's lab. I just want to get a feeling. You asked the question about speed. You know, everything has a price. These dyes are slow. But if you're asking what connectivity is, you're not asking the network to work at its highest rate. You're just asking that, in fact, the synapses can operate at a slow rate. Okay, and then I can still detect my signals when I'm stimulated at a sort of a slow frequency. Now, it turns out that there's a natural rhythm for this animal. The leech tends to swim at about 1 hertz, okay? So what Adam did, in fact, is kind of cute. This is something that probably was very, very, very difficult before, was he had an electrode in the trigger cell in the head. And if you go to a leech and they sort of suck onto you, right? And this sort of activates their little brain, and all of a sudden they start to swim, right? Just like little kids latching onto mama, okay? And what Adam did is he had this roadmap. Okay, the picture's a little fuzzy because it's a whole field image, right? But you can make out individual neurons. And label individual neurons. And he drove this one cell. So he's in this trigger cell in the head. And he put a current in that's going, right? The cell is just firing, right? Every once a second. And then he's just measuring in parallel from every possible cell using this kind of contrast mechanism. So every cell that's affected by the trigger cell is having a re-equilibration of these fluorophores going back and forth. Okay, with the trigger signal. And cells that don't have this re-equilibration going on. And then you can just measure from every cell. Now, all this looks like a lot of noise. Okay, so I'm going to... But we're really asking for which of these guys have a little bit of modulation at 1 hertz. So this guy, you can just barely see that it has a little bit of modulation at 1 hertz. Okay, I could go into more spectral decomposition than you'll never want to do it again in your life, okay? But the point is, you could look at every cell, you have a reference signal. It's a great way to detect circuits. You have a reference signal. Drive. You do very standard lock-in detection. And you say, well, look at this guy. This signal is being modulated coherently with the drive. You could do some statistics, blah, blah, blah. And then you say, well, how do you prove it? So I've looked at, okay, in this case, we've looked at about 34 cells at the same time, right? So that's a heck of a lot better than looking at two at once. And then, of course, you could just prove it by very nicely then going into the one pair that you suspect with an electrode. So as a means to, again, this, the fine circuits like I showed for all these central pattern generators. We've kept our electrode in trigger cell 2. Now you go into the cell that your optical method said was active, and just to really nail it, so to speak, you stick an electrode in the cell. You drive cell 2, okay? You use the drive to do spike triggered averaging in cell 2. Okay, so every time somebody in spike triggered averaging means the following. I have my current going like this. I look at the voltage in this one cell, and it's doing this. And then I look at so this would be the voltage in TR2. And then I look at the voltage in TR in number 7. It's doing something. So I just take this piece, snip it out, move it over here. Take this piece, snip it out, move it over here so the spikes align. So I have an accurate reference. And then, in fact, I see very nicely that I get something that looks like a 5 millivolt or 5 meter signal in cell 207. Okay. So what I've done is I've sketched how we could think about not measuring voltage directly, but using some optical mechanism whose optical spectrum changes with voltage. That constitutes a contrast mechanism that allows us to look at a lot of sites at once. And one thing that this allowed you to do was to look at active propagation, to look at dynamics, at the whole picture, and see things you normally don't see, like reflection of pulses. And then as a way to learn about circuits, it offers you a way to do tracing that scales like n instead of n squared. Okay, so what I'll do after the break is talk a little bit about how, rather than looking at many points in a single cell or tracing, how you can use these sort of averaging techniques to do two things. So one is to do look at watt scale dynamics. Okay, so I'll just build a little bit of what Barr talked about and just show you how you could use these to say, look at wave motion, okay, in a whole brain. Okay, and then I want to talk a little bit about functional imaging. And this will be important for two reasons. First, this is sort of the tool of choice to make maps. And tomorrow, Fred Wolf is going to talk about sort of the physics of how maps are built. I want to talk about how actually they're measured. And I think with luck, it'll tie in very nicely with Rick Buxton's talk on functional magnetic resonance imaging, which uses the same contrast techniques. Okay. So let's just meet back a little after 11, okay? Okay, so I think a way to explain the imaging is let me give this a try. There's a couple of limits in imaging. So I'm gonna, there's sort of the limit where the wavelength of light comes in, and then there's the limit where the aperture comes in, which is the geometrical limit. And at different times, one works in one versus the other. Now, the diffraction limit is kind of well known to everybody. You have a lens, and you come into a focus, and the width of this focus goes like a wavelength, and it depends a little bit on a geometrical factor, and the geometrical factor, there's sort of a diameter of your lens, and then there's kind of the distance you are to the focal plane of your object, and this is this is sort of known as the F number, right? You go to your camera, and you know you say, okay, I want such a camera, I want F F2, and they say it's $50, and you say you want F1, and they say it's $1,000, and you say F, you know, and it's you know, the bigger the glass, the smaller the F number, right? Goes like, okay. This size depends on the sort of the geometry. It's the size that it goes in is the wavelength times this geometrical factor, this F number. So but the point is that at the end of the day, you're ultimately limited by something on the order of the wavelength of the light in what you can resolve. So with the right interference tricks or whatever, you often could get down to a fraction of a wavelength, maybe a quarter of a wavelength. Okay, but that defines the limit. Now sometimes you're actually not interested in looking at this looking at the diffraction limited resolution. What you really have is you want to look over a region which in a sense is very many diffraction limits, okay, sort of a large region. And you ask a somewhat different question, okay, which is that how far down or up do I have to move? So, I'll just do this here. So again, this is my image point. This is my object, and this is my image point. I'm just sketching this. I'm not trying to give an optics lesson, right? And this point is now in focus here, and I could say that's fine, right? What I really want to do is look over a large region. So how out of focus could I be, okay, before, say, on my detector, I spill over to an additional pixel? Right. I mean, nobody uses film today, right? We're in the days of digital detectors, and it's sort of nice because you could ask, how far do I move until this little spot spills over into my next detector? Right. So that's sort of a geometrical limit, and it's for many imaging modalities, it's appropriate, and it's particularly appropriate when you want to look at a large area and you're sort of guided by physiology, as saying how, you know, I want to look at like 100 cells, average over 100 cells. So you're not diffraction limited. So I'll talk about examples from this, and this usually goes under the name of wide field imaging, and this is just sort of diffraction limited imaging. Okay. So what are the kind of questions that one could ask? So I just want to get the time right. Rick Buxton is here. Rick is going to talk about fMRI this afternoon. Let's see. I'll try to make sure I stop by 12:30, right? And then we can regroup by 2, and that goes from 2 to 5, and your plane is at 6:30. So we're all times work out, okay? Okay, so let me just I'm just going to jump to one particular example with respect to this image of dyes. This is work done. This particular work is done with a fellow Jim Prechtel. Ted Bullock contributed to this work. Ted is 85 years old. We wrote a paper last year. He gave me a harder time than most people one-third his age. It was fantastic. Okay. Partha Mitra and Bizan Basaran contributed to this work. Okay. So just to give you a little sketch, what Ted had found early on is that every time, if you look in, now the turtle, Larry talked about receptive fields in V1, and before then we talked about sort of other areas like motion-sensitive areas in the mammalian brain, but there is like medial temporal, MT. So the turtle doesn't have all this V1, V2, okay? It's basically a motion-sensitive animal. It has this equivalent of this pulvinar input into MT, right? So just think of this as half a monkey if you really feel mammalian-centric. And what Ted had found early on is that if you recorded, okay, in this visual area of dorsal cortex, which is just shown here by left cortex, the point is every time the animal actually moved its eye to track an object, the cortex sort of broke into these oscillations. So he sort of found evidence early on for oscillatory motion when the animal was attending. Okay. And it was actually kind of interesting motion, because it pushed this issue of single trials, which is kind of important. So when Larry talked about receptive field properties of individual cells, it was always in the sense of averaging. So maybe you did something like a correlation, reverse correlation method, but you had a stimulus running for a very long time, and so you're averaging over the spikes in the past. Or you thought of making the receptive field by, before I talked about something like spike-triggered averaging. Okay, so now you have to ask yourself, well, that's great. I could define the output of a cell based on its average response. But what about the sort of instantaneous response that you could get from a cell? Suppose there's some underlying dynamics, and the phase or the detailed timing of the dynamics does not repeat from trial to trial, right? So it forces the technical issue of being able to record not just on fast time scales, but with sufficient signal to noise to resolve the activity on a single trial. Okay. Now, dangerous situation here. Okay. Ted and Jim again had recorded in visual dorsal cortex, and one thing that they found is that if you gave just a flash of light, right, sort of the optical, I don't have my little strobe with me, right, a little flash of light, and you average the signal, you'd find out there was some sort of very large depolarization in the field potential, be it ill-defined as it will. The cells are becoming depolarized, the outside of the cell becomes hyperpolarized, the field potential goes negative, okay? But they also found that every time they gave this flash of light, that they actually got the cortex breaking into little oscillations. And you could see this, and each one of these is a single trial, right? And it flash after flash after flash shows the same characteristic, which would be sharp in frequency space, okay? But in time, in fact, it's spread out, many oscillations with a different phase. And sort of coming on a background of previous work in olfactory systems that shows that there were sort of wave dynamics in architectures where the connectivity between neurons was short range, right? So physics kind of teaches you that nature likes a twist. So if I have a lattice or a neural network where it's not all-to-all connections, like Misha talked about in the sense of the Hopfield network, but you actually have connections that have a limited range. Okay, and that limited range has a spatial organization, so you tend to be hooked up to neighbors that are so far apart, and then you move a little bit and you're hooked up to neighbors that are so far apart. Nature sort of likes to have a twist, like a twist in the phase, or if this was a spin material, you would actually see the magnetization vector twist as you went through the material. Okay, so we had a system that oscillated, that's great, you know, we're physicists, we're happy, you know, frequency domain, everybody gets very excited. It's a signature. Okay, short-range connections, and then you have an animal. Okay, let me bring my turtle picture. Okay. Okay, this is not exactly a turtle in the wild. Okay, this is a turtle, you know, sitting under a lens in a dichroic mirror. But just to give you an idea of the preparation, you can, for reasons that have become apparent a little bit, and this is a preparation for which you could remove the blood. So heme has some very, very strong absorptions, and I'll exploit these in a minute when I talk about functional imaging. Okay, it has very strong absorption, which can change with activity, but it's also a source of additional variability, because you have an absorber moving into the field, out of the field, into the field, out of the field, right? I mean, just, you know, next time you bleed, just take a good look under the microscope, right? I mean, you know, you have these relatively large, you know, on this optical scale, relatively large cells filling up your field. And the turtle, this is so bizarre. There's a paper published from Transylvania, right? I'm not kidding. I kid you not. In 1971, on how to make a bloodless prep. It's too good to be true. Maybe somebody's joke and I fell for it, but I got the paper. So you could actually perfuse these animals, right? You can go into the, you know, pick two of the four carotids and one of the four carotids and just basically perfuse this guy with saline, you know, backed in with some dextran to keep the vessels open, right? It's a time order technique, and Rodolfo Enos has even applied this to to isolate a mammalian brains, right? So it hasn't been exploited very much, but I think it's very fascinating. So we were able to have this preparation. So it's basically an awake, you know, preparation. It's paralyzed from the neck back, but it's able to move its eyes in principle, so it can attend. All this is very critical. The idea of single trial recording on awake attending preparations. Okay, and So the question we're going to ask. I'm focusing a little bit on the technical issues here, but the questions we're going to ask is that we had a system that oscillates. We have a system where a lot of anatomy, mostly done by this fellow Phil Yawinski in Chicago, you know, says that the system is much bigger, okay, than the range of the connections. And as physicists, you say this just cries waves. Okay, so I just want to talk about how you could use this technology first started by Larry Cohn to look for such large-scale behavior. Okay, so to give you an idea of what we're doing, this is a cross-section through the brain of the turtle. It's a three-layered cortex, right? People think that modern neocortex or new cortex was actually, you know, three-layer cortex gone awry that folded it on itself, right? So, you know, layer one and layer four were kind of kissing cousins. And we're looking at a part of the cortex, which gets an input that basically gets from sort of an equivalent thalamic structure directly comes into this area called D1. So it's a flat brain, like rodents, so it's very easy to record from. Okay. And the other thing you have to do is, so just to give you a sketch, okay, of what happens here. Now, you don't want to start using very, very fancy toys, but, well, okay, that's fine. Just to make progress. So this is sort of what happens in this preparation, right? So you saw the preparation before. You have this turtle. Turtle's there, okay? The thing that really gives a turtle an amazing response is when you have a looming stimulus. And it's Ford Ebner, who's has also entered the rat world and since become a collaborator. It's a small world, okay, showed very early on with his then-student Kalacki that actually, if you want to get plasticity in this prep, you just have to set to pair a looming stimulus with an adverse like shock, okay? And so what we do, we're looking down and we're recording, just like in the data I showed for Dayan from on single cells, we're recording from a couple hundred sites, okay? And one does the usual thing, one fills your field with areas that you believe should be responsive to the motor, to the sensory cortex, in this case the visual cortex, which before this you've made maps, you've done all the good things, and you fill it with fields that you think should not be terribly responsive, okay, which is D1 is not responsive, D2 should be responsive, just so you have controls. And the kind of thing that you look for is that when you stimulate and you look at your optical signal, okay, so unlike the field potential, which doesn't contain the sort of DC part, right? Here you see the full depolarization of the cell. That's a big step up. It dribbles down very slowly over time. Okay, and on top of it, you see all these little wiggles. These are these fast oscillations. So the analysis I'm going to do is focused on these fast oscillations. So you go in with a pair of digital scissors, right? And we cut out the step. We get these fast. You can do again. I think it's as in any area of science, it's a general rule. It's good to have two techniques to confirm anything. If you look at the local field potential, which is sort of a mixture of the signal and the derivative of the signal in this case, because we're kind of slow, it's not so far away from the optical signal. And the thing that we're actually interested in looking at here is these oscillations, and they occupy a nice little spectral peak. Okay, so we're interested in signals at a fairly narrow band. So that's going to be one of our tools. Okay. Yeah. What? The stimulus is five seconds. This will become a little bit critical in a moment. Okay. I'll show you. Keep your pants on. Okay, they're pretty constant. Otherwise, we couldn't do what we're doing, right? Well, I mean, you saw that early on. And this is just a flash of light. This is just a single flash of light. And this is going on for about 1 second, just due to the single, that's sort of a, okay, in our case, they're actually oscillating over the full 5 second time period. This will become apparent in a moment, okay? So again, let me give you kind of idea of what one's measuring in this. I mean, we're used to putting in single wires and recording from a single cell. We talked about the local field potential where if you record as differences between multiple wires, you can define your volume. Okay, if you record from a single wire, you have ill-defined volumes. In the sense of these kind of large-scale optical measurements, and this holds here as in these kind of intrinsic images, okay, you stain the cells with a dye. Okay, everybody that has an electrical change within your optical volume is fair game. All right, so you're averaging over an optical volume. So on the one sense, as long as the scattering is not too severe, your volume is well defined. Your volume is well defined. In another sense, what cell types are in the volume is poorly defined. Okay, so this method can suffer a little bit. And I just mentioned in words in that in preparations, like there was an olfactory preparation where we knew exactly the two cell types. And then you could, in that case, reconstruct the optical signal based on the two cell types. Here, we don't know quite enough, right? So every technique has its dirt, okay? But nonetheless, this is what we're doing. We're sort of focusing in, and we're recording from a volume which is, you know, kind of about this big, right? One hand on this scale. Okay, so what do you see? What do you get out of this kind of stuff? Okay, well, the first thing you learn is that unprocessed data doesn't tell you so very much. So let me see what we have across the top. What we've done is we have this field of view. And remember, this is sort of the visual part of the field. And this is the non-visual part of the field. And what I've done is I've just sort of selected a couple of the hot pixels, right? And I've taken their power, the spectral power density and the moving window. So it's a function of time. And there's just stuff at low frequencies. And we said we don't really understand that. But and in this case, actually, we do a little bit. And then finally, the stimulus turns on, right? And all hell breaks loose, and power goes up everywhere. But in particular, we pick up a band. And if I just take a little cross-section through this window, so between 1.5 and 2.5 seconds after the stimulus turned on, there's a peak, OK? If it's 20 hertz. So the first thing that happens, you say, gee, I am in big trouble because there's all this stuff at low frequency, and that's all I'm going to see, right? And this is a little bit, it's like driving up from San Diego. You pass these roads where you notice there's like three roads going on top of you, right? And you can imagine looking down from the top and reporting on the flux of cars, right? And you'd never be able to distinguish anything, okay? But of course, each road has a signature, like some are stopped and some are moving at, you know, 20 miles an hour, okay? So if you were to just do the same kind of candy-colored tricks that I showed you in Dayan's data at different epochs of time. So here we're these are like 7 milliseconds, or about 100. This is about 150 hertz sampling, fairly fast. What we see is okay. There's this sort of a hot spot due to the having this visual stimulus. Okay, so we said the thing oscillates at around 20 hertz. So 20 hertz is about 50 milliseconds. Okay, so you know we expect this thing to blink, you know, on kind of every 8 frames or so. And, you know, if we see this sort of hot spot, then it's moving across, and then it starts to blink, and as we go into the second cycle, and it turns into a hyperpolarizing spot. Okay. Okay, so now we look at this, and now we have to sort of, like, take off our biology hat and put on our computational neuroscience hat, right? Because What we've shown is that, in one sense, space and time are linked, right, in this receptive field. Or if I look at in this cortex, I mean, you have a stimulus, the neural activity is clearly drifting from site to site. Okay, so you would expect automatically to get these kind of mixed space-time receptive fields that Larry Abbott talked about. On the other hand, it looks hopelessly complex, okay? But so how do we make a little bit of progress. Okay, so I'm just going to, let me show a result, okay, and then I'm going to back up and sketch, and just sketch how you got there, okay? The thing we know is that this thing already had a well-defined oscillation, so it was sharp, it was reasonably sharp around a certain spectral band. And the thing we know is that when the stimulus came on, we always got this oscillation, but it came in with a different phase. So the space things are, if we have any hope, things are going to be sharp in a frequency space, even though they're kind of smeared out in time space. So one thing to think about is instead of having images, you know, space as a function of time, what you really want to think about is images is space as a function of frequency. Okay, and the way you get this just becomes a technical issue, the best way to do it. But the basic idea is that you now have things that are kind of sharp in frequency space. Right. So in general, I think with any data, you know, there's the old uncertainty product, right? That the frequency band times the time band is order one. Right? So I took data for 5 seconds. That just is a way of saying that I have a frequency response which is like 1/1/5 or fifth of a hertz, right? This kind of game. But I could move back and forth between these spaces. So just to, again, sketch. This is an interesting technique because it had its origins in the touch tone telephone, as I'll describe in a moment. But what we can do is we could look at the data as a function of frequency. And let's just look before the stimulus happens, okay? What we've done is like I said, there was only stuff at low frequency. I'll define the coherence in a moment, but this is looking over, it's asking if there's a pattern which is continuous over the entire space, okay? And in fact, there's only sort of a pattern at very low frequency, okay? And for that pattern, okay, it's in frequency space, it's a complex number, so there's a phase which corresponds to a direction in space, okay, and there's a magnitude, and this will correspond to propagating waves moving along this direction in space with no apparent hotspot. Okay, it will turn out that this exactly matches the direction of the afferent inputs. So it's no biggie. But then the stimulus comes on. Okay, and I'll sketch, I again could look for places in which there's some spatial coherence, okay, as a function of frequency. All right, and in fact, I get a number of peaks. I get one at low frequency, which again points to the same direction. So that makes me kind of happy. Something repeats, right? If it's you know, Larry Abbott talked about there being, you know, trafficking in both directions on these thalamic afferents, and the thalamus is active in the dark state, right? So you expect to see activity, you know, before and after the stimulation. But when the stimulation comes on, in fact, you find out that the brain picks out additional modes, including one at around that favorite frequency, at around 20 hertz. And this corresponds to propagation in a different direction. Okay, so this was a complete fuzzball in time. But when we chopped up the signal in frequency space, we find out we have very simple, well-defined patterns. So it's just, again, something to think about. Some of you go on and work with different experimental groups. Some of you do experiments, think about analyzing your data. You obviously have to think about, you know, if you have a sharp peak in the frequency domain, think frequency space, right? It's no-brainer. Okay, it's no brainer. Okay, so let me just sketch the essential science that goes on here. You can have very many oscillators. We can look at each site, each pixel, right? And we could say the following. Let me just look at the spectrum at, say, site one. Or this would be the optical signal. I'll just draw these. At site one and site two as a function of frequency. And the spectrum could do a number of things. I'm just going to draw them like this, just for fun. Okay. Now, these guys sort of have the same frequency composition, but this doesn't tell you that they're actually moving at the same time, that they're following each other. The issue of things being coherent is to look across, let's say, two sites. And when this guy decides to go up a little bit in frequency, this one goes up in frequency. And when this one goes down a little bit in frequency, this one goes down in frequency. So if you have a spectral band which is a little broad, right, you have a little wiggle room. And you're asking if, as a function of time into the experiment, the frequency compositions move the same way. So you're asking if they're coherent the same way. And really what's, okay, so what just, I'll just leave it at that. I could discuss the methodology after if somebody's interested, okay? So we're basically asking if there's a stable pattern in which people move up and down together, and you get out the stable pattern. Okay, so then you're really happy. But then, okay, so you ask the question is how long does the oscillation go for, right? So the nice thing that we have here is that we had an experiment that lasted 5 seconds. We had a spectral band that was about 2 hertz wide or 3 hertz wide, right? So let's think about it. I mean, we had an ultimate spectral resolution of 1/5 of a second, right? But this guy was about 2 hertz wide. So this is about, this looks like 10 × 1/5 of a hertz. So this is like 10 added degrees of freedom, right? So these are these extra degrees of freedom that we could average over, right, to decide if two things are tracking. All right, it turns out there's this cute technical thing. There's a wonderful set of basis functions to analyze in the frequency domain. And they came about because the touch tone phone was invented in the very late 50s. And the fellow named David Slepian looked back at the issue of spectral analysis to make, you know, to minimize the leakage of estimating power at one frequency band from another frequency band, and defined the set defined the basis set for the frequency analysis. And they're computationally intensive, but you know, today they run on your laptop, and you could define perfect spectra. I mean, like the brick walls engineers like to talk about. Okay, all because of the touchtone phone. Anyway. Okay. This is data which is taken over looking at the whole 5 seconds, and you see a dominant pattern. And again, it's a little bit fun to look back, and you can say, that's cool. But since I know a little bit of the answer, I could do, again, something very, very simple from the engineering world. Okay. I said I have an oscillation which mostly takes place at 20 hertz. It's a dominant effect. And it's other data that shows that that's the behavioral relevant oscillation. So what do you do to your data to pick out just that piece? What's the cool technique? OK, we could Fourier transform and have a moving window, right? But then I could look at the power, right? I've lost phase information. I've lost relative timing information. Okay, what do you do? You're cruising up the San Diego freeway, or usually not cruising up, usually sitting there, you know, bumper to bumper, and you're turning your dial, and you are, what? Phase locking, and then you take the output of the phase lock loop, and it goes up to your signal, and it demodulates, right? Okay, so what you're doing is you have a signal as a function of time, right? And you're hitting it, right, demodulation, you're just hitting it with an operator and integrating out over time on some window, right, and you're sort of picking out the part of it which is at this frequency, right, that's what demodulation is. So we could do the same thing here. We have a signal which is a function of time, right, and we just act on it, you know, with e to the I omega naught t, and this picks out, you know, the part which is at omega naught. Obviously, the longer we could average over time, the better our frequency, our spectral resolution. But what we see is the following. Can you just hit one of the lights?
It's like a window for Fourier transform.
What?
It's like a window for Fourier transform.
Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, just in a nutshell, what we've done here is we've coded the intensity of the demodulation with the saturation of the color, and then the hue is the phase. And, you know, before we talked about a wave moving off in this direction, okay, towards the upper right, and you can sort of see this gradient of color. And this is, if you averaged all these patterns together, here's later, see a gradient in this along this direction. See a gradient along this direction. Earlier, you see a gradient along this direction. So if you averaged all these together, you should get out that dominant pattern at 20 hertz, and indeed you do. But I made a point at the beginning of what happens on single trials. It's important to look at, and this is just sort of one indication. I mean, the other sort of generic pattern that one expects from short-range systems in physics is sort of the idea of a vortex or a or a rotating wave. And if you look at these brief epochs in time, you actually see, you know, a point, and you see all these different phases around the point. And that's just shown here with contour lines, okay, indicating breaks in phases. Okay, so I think what's nice is that this critter, you know, this critter was kind of a physicist's delight, you know, just based on naive notions about connectivity. It sort of exhibited all the basic generic waveforms. And the point I wanted to show you here is that if you had averaged this data, if you'd repeated this experiment a few times and taken the data sets and averaged them together, if you had done a spike triggered or anything triggered anything, right, you lose this kind of information. So it's very important to look at single trial data, you know, often. And I mean, the critical thing that repeats is if you do the experiment over and over again, you expect to see the same generic patterns, and you expect to see the same spectral response. But the relative timing, of course, is different between trials. Okay. So this is more. A number of people are trying to push this into the mammalian cortex. Yeah. Oh yeah. So, all right. This makes up for the last question I couldn't answer. Okay. In a nutshell, this is data from Phil Yawinski. If you look in Journal of Comparative Neuroscience, every other figure looks like this: piece of brain and a blob. Right? The blob is dye that was put into the brain that gets taken up by neurons. This is a lectin. Blah blah blah. Okay. But the point is that you see little segments get labeled. All right, so man, talk about a boring thesis. Okay, so one of Phil's students actually looked at the directionality of all these segments. Okay, these are axonal segments, and this is the raw data. There's a little bit of a bias. It's double peaked. It's orientation, so it's obviously double peaked, right? And so the bias from Phil's paper matches up, it turns out, with the optical bias, which came first. So, I mean, I think what's happening is that the direction of propagation at least is consistent with a little bit of a bias of the axonal fibers. Okay. I love these questions. Any other questions? Ah, okay.
The way in which these patterns evolve is related to the stimulus.
That's a fair point. So a number of things about the stimulus were changed, like the direction in which the stimulus came, but, you know, I mean, not things about the physical size of the stimulus.
But I think the nature of the stimulus, for example, different
that wasn't explored in any depth. I mean, we're kind of focused on dynamics. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So again, I think this general. Lots of labs sort of recognize this general importance of measuring from many sites, doing it in single trials to get at the underlying dynamics. And I think more and more people do what people have done in engineering now for maybe three decades, which is look more and more in the frequency domain. And there's a lot of nice reasons to do this. I mean, different frequency bands have statistically independent errors. There's just a lot of good statistics reasons to sort of play your games there. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about is, I'm going to talk about functional imaging. If we have 5 minutes left, I'll talk about scanning. Okay, so both of these are techniques which are really sort of hot to trot. Okay. What's going on? Okay. As I mentioned, there's a number of intrinsic. So I'm switching gears now. And before, I talked about measurements on the voltage of cells in real time. Okay. Now, sometimes you can't actually get access to the voltage, because everything we did relied on an external indicator. Now, that there were a couple of papers, including one some years ago from our own lab, looking at changes of refractive index from the cells, and they're fast and they're fun, and Omar's thesis is to try to make them useful. But right now they're fast and fun and cute, and my mother thinks they're great. But the things that really have a lot of people so far to make real scientific progress are either by adding extrinsic indicators, or just saying, I give up. Okay, I'm not going to look at the voltage, because I just can't get access to the tissue, or because it's too invasive. I got to stick these damn dye molecules in, and it's true, it's a high impedance measurement, but then the cells burn out, or all sorts of pharmacological problems. So there was a body of work that really started with Britton Chance, and came to the forefront with a paper by Gary Blaisdell in about 84, 85, and a paper by Greenwald and Charles Gilbert and Torsten Wiesel in 84, 85. And this is used oxygen, changes in oxygen as a contrast mechanism. And again, Rick will talk about the magnetic analogy of this afternoon in part of his talk, but this is a thing. If you look at, this is the spectrum, the absorption spectrum of three things. It's water, which is the dashed line, right? The spectrum of water is amazing, because if I go a little bit longer wavelength, it's going to start to shoot up by orders of magnitude. And if I go a little bit shorter wavelengths into the UV, it's going to shoot up by orders of magnitude. I mean, it's very interesting that the absorption of water and that sort of peak wavelength of the sun are just, you know, sitting right on top of each other, right? But if we look, in fact, out at these wavelengths in the red to near infrared, we see that in going from oxygenated to deoxygenated hemoglobin, there's a significant change in absorption. Okay, and this change, this difference, right? So the contrast between the two molecules, although not the absolute absorption, peaks at around 620 and peaks again at about 1100 nanometers, right? And from a technical point of view, this is a hard wavelength to get at, because the band gap in silicon is around here, closer to a micron. So the detectors here are not very efficient, and they're costly, right? They're sort of gallium arsenide detectors. But this is sitting, I mean, right where just, you know, you buy your Sony CCD camera for $70, and you have a detector with a 40% quantum efficiency sitting right at this window, right? So it's quite enormous. Okay, and this was really exploited to do imaging. Let me just give you a little bit of a feel. Okay, now what you're doing in this is that you're saying is that the neurons fired. Okay, so as one might say, as a homework exercise, you could compute the power dissipated, the integral IDV, okay, during an action potential, and you could compute the integral of IDV in sort of a synaptic activation, and you should convince yourself that the synaptic activation is around 10 picojoules is the energy in synaptic activation, and it's not so much different during an action potential. So you're pretty much dominated by synapses going off. And there's a recent paper by Nikos Agathios on sort of the correlation between fMRI signals and metabolic activity, and this is roughly what he finds. And what you're saying is that I'm not measuring neural activity. I am measuring changes in metabolism. And worse than that, I am not measuring changes in metabolism. I am measuring changes in oxygen concentration of the blood. And I have a model, or Rick has a model, that suggests that the two are connected. Okay. Now, there's a little bit of a reach here, right? Because when you go to the neuroscience meeting, right, and you know they have all these poster sessions. I don't know how many of you have gone there. And you look to your right, and you see all these posters on mapping, and people will use every technique in the book, including this optical mapping or fMRI. And you know they'll have a monkey, and they'll go this, and you know some part of the brain will increase its oxygen concentration and get these spectacular maps. And then you look in the other aisle, and people talk about how doing this to the monkey doesn't affect the spiking rate, but affects the synchronization among the spikes. So it's not obvious there should be any change in metabolism. But with that caveat in mind, okay, one can go ahead and one can use this, okay, to infer neural activity. Now the cool thing about it is you're not adding anything to the animal. The cool thing about it is you can use this as a way to make maps to determine where to sink your electrode. So Dan So, who's at the Rockefeller, has really exploited this very heavily to say, whatever mechanism causes this, at least I want to find the part of the visual cortex that responds to a stimulus here, moving, you know, with this orientation. So it's a very, very powerful technique for map making, at the least, okay? And so let's see what happens. Again, there's data from a number of labs. I'm just picking data that came from Ron Frostig's lab, who's just down in Irvine. And Ron's data is particularly nice because there's very little vasculature in the skull. The only thing the skull does is scatter, okay? And even in these bright field techniques, you actually can average out a lot of that scatter. And so you could take a rodent, and you could thin its skull. So you've maintained the integrity as far as pressure of the brain, and you've maintained the integrity of the skull as far as temperature, right? I mean, you open up an animal and you're sitting here with, you know, a 100-gram lens sitting above the animal. I mean, the heat capacity is pretty severe. And basically what Ron did is he sat at this wavelength, 650 nanometers, and looked at the oxy-deoxy different. Now, I'm just sort of, if you look at the signals that he's measured, he's come here, and this is over the somatosensory area, the whisker area of the rat. That's not very important. Each of these, as this is just like one of these little Larry Cohn pictures. This is a time trace of what's going on in a pixel looking at this part of the brain. Okay, so think of carving this up into a little box. This looks like the average change in the reflectance of the light. So I said the absorption changes, right? But if the absorption changes, if the absorption goes up, right, then the reflectance has to go down. Okay? Light's going in, diffusing, bouncing around in some very model-dependent matter, which people fight about like mad, okay? And then a certain amount of it comes out, okay? But I think the important thing is that this is unmarked. This is a time scale of 2.5 seconds, and you could see that this particular part of the field is that you get this signal that first goes up, okay? And up corresponds, in this particular case, to net deoxy, and then it goes down, which corresponds to net oxy. And then Ron prepared a number of maps by averaging over different slices of time. And what you could see very nicely is you see sort of a change, okay, in the reflectance, which was induced by stimulation, right? So no external indicators have been added, and it's just to confirm that it's really something to do with the bloodstream. We're actually looking at a surface vessel, okay, which is actually changing its absorption over time. So this is probably a vein on the surface, right? And it's actually our reflectance is going way down, okay? It's called dark. Okay, so this is sort of the basic idea of the map, and just to kind of sketch a couple of things. So you may say, well, okay, that's great, David, but you also talked about these changes due to swelling and scattering that happen. And how can we actually find out what part of this may be due to scattering and what part is due to the bloodstream? That's sort of a first control experiment. And, an experiment that could only be proved by an Iacocca committee in Japan, you can take out the blood, okay? Cool. Right. Return of the Transylvanians. So you really can make artificial blood solutions. This is using effectively freon, okay? So not only have they bled the animal to death, they're increasing the ozone hole or something, but you fill this poor animal with freon, you fill it with a certain amount of dextran, you fill it with a certain amount of bicarbonate, and actually the animal works. That's the amazing thing. And you know it works because they're imaging over a part of somatosensory cortex. This is a pretty heavy stimulus, right? This is This is something that was probably used in Argentina in the late 70s. This is putting a wire into a nerve and stimulating the animal. And looking at the local field potential in cortex, and looking at the local field potential after we've transfused it, okay? And the local field potential is still very good. I mean, they did the nice control. But in fact, if you look at the net reflectance, okay, beforehand, again, you don't have this initial, this doesn't show evidence for this initial deoxy blip, which, as I've learned, is quite the controversy, so I'll ignore it. But you see a very nice change in the reflectance, okay? And then it's gone, right? So if you look at their data carefully, it looks at most the scattering signal is about 15% or less. Okay, so it's really oxygen, which is our heme, oxy and deoxy heme, which gives you these signals. Okay, so this I thought was important data to justify this. And again, this is now this data again comes from Ron Frostig. And what Ron did was he wiggled, this was a rat, and he wiggled one whisker on the rat, and he looked at the sort of spread of neural activity. And he also, as far as looking at the amplitude, okay, this reflectance signal, the maximum amplitude, just sort of arbitrarily put a line here, and then he just moved this electrode, marched it along different sites, which are these black dots, and then just recorded the number of spikes. Okay, and when he did this, fortunately the scale changes. This is 80, this is 20, and 20 here is maybe the background here is 5 or so, and the background here is also 5. So you get pretty consistent data. So in a crude sense here, he didn't measure field potential, but is looking at the spiking, right? So the amplitude of the signal averaged over many hundreds of microns is not unreasonable on the scale of the amount of spikes. So it's qualitatively a good correlate. You can kind of see now why maps would be formed, right? Because you might have popped a hole in the skull, put an electrode in, moved individual whiskers, you the labeled spot, just like Sebastian showed in the visual cortex in the Hubel-Wiesel papers. You can kind of see how it's going to come out here. And then just to push a little bit further, okay. So if you look in the we didn't really talk about the idea of columns very much, but the whole idea of this idea of the map. So I'm just going to slow down a little bit because this is going to come up again tomorrow, okay? When Fred talks about maps. The one thing you notice is that these signals grow very slowly. They grow on the time scale of 1 second. All right, so let's think about behavior, right? It takes about 150 milliseconds for the ball. How does it take? It takes about 500 milliseconds for a ball to go from sort of the pitcher's mound to the home plate, right? In baseball. Right, so basically, by the time the signal had started to rise, okay, I mean, the pitcher's committed himself, the batter's made a decision and started to move, and all the mechanical events are over, right? So we're not exactly talking about behaviorally relevant time scales, okay, but nonetheless, from the point of view of making map making, it really doesn't matter. Just like from the point of finding connectivity. Right, as long as you show two guys interact, you really don't care about the time. Right, so but for making maps, it's really beautiful. And this is data from Ron Frostig, and this again was done in a thin skull. So I think this just sort of emphasizes the power of the technique. And so if you remember back in this case, you have the vibrissa. Okay, and or this could have been a retina. Okay, in which case, this has a ganglion. Another ganglion. Okay, so this could have been photoreceptors. This could have been bipolar cells. This could have been retinal ganglion cells. Okay, now we've all caught up with each other, right? These go off to various thalamic nuclei. And then these go off to primary cortex. Okay, and there's this notion of map, which is I think it's Fred will talk about tomorrow, seems to be a developmental issue. But what it says is that in the case of photoreceptors, here's my visual world, my widescreen visual world. Here's a part of the field, I'll call this X. Here's a part of the field, I'll call this Y, and here's another part I'll call Z. And then if I look down at the cortex, what I'll find is that there's roughly a one-to-one mapping. Okay, it's a distorted mapping, but there's roughly a one-to-one mapping. So when I look at V1 for the visual system, I'll see an area of X, an area for Y, and then an area for Z with some distortion. It can't be a perfect map because there's other feature selectivity. So you're mapping many features onto two dimensions. And each of these regions, or if they're characterized electrically, this is what, if you remember in Larry Abbott's data, he showed that there's a region where a bar would cause a neurons to be excited and then cause their spiking rate to go down. But you could try to draw a circle around that or an ellipse around that region whose size was kind of, you know, sigma x, you know, square root of sigma x squared and sigma y squared. So this is sort of the receptive field of the cell, sort of bound. This is like the bound of this Gaussian that Larry talked about, okay? Now, this notion, it just happens, becomes particularly clear in these regions in somatosensory cortex, okay? And particularly in all rodents or any kind of mammal that has very discrete tactile representation. So whether it's a mole or a rat, what you tend to see is that there's a region that corresponds to one of the whiskers. Okay, so this would say be whisker 1, and this would be whisker 2. And what's really very, very striking is that if you look at the level of the afferent inputs, so if I take my map now, I'm going to flip it on the side. Okay, so here's the top of cortex, which is what is called the pia. Right, and this is the white matter, which are just fiber tracts. Okay. Here's thalamus from below. We have fibers that come in and they exit. And they mostly branch heavily in this middle layer. This is called layer 4. It's not really important. And they branch a little bit up on top and they also branch down in layer 6, but they're most dense here. Okay, this is where the presynaptic terminals are the densest. We said before that most of the energy metabolism is at the synapses. So this, in fact, is where the synapses have their highest density. The metabolic load is at the highest density. Okay, right around here. Okay, and then you have vasculature diving down. Okay. From the surface. You have arteries that come up around the side of your head, drop down, then you have a return flow that goes out towards the midline in your head, right? That's why you're supposed to wear a bicycle helmet, because you never want to get whacked right on the top of your head, okay? And so in the somatosensory cortex, what happens is you actually have a little glial boundaries that define where region 1 comes in, as opposed to where region 2 comes in. Okay. And Mountcastle kind of christened these kind of regions, which have sort of a rather definitive form in the case of hairs in vibration-sensitive hairs in somatosensory cortex, and a more nebulous form in the case of the visual system. These are called cortical columns. You can just see the entasis just unfold before your eye or something like that, right? But this is, so it's a little bit of an abstract idea, but to the extent that the afferents from a given part of visual space cluster together and come into a region of cortex, you can imagine that you're mostly exciting this region. And this is the notion of maps. And in this particular optical technique, what's happening is that you're moving one vibrissa all the afferents from that vibrissa are coming into this region. Okay, so the local blood flow, okay, the metabolism is increased in this region. Okay, so you have three things. You have localized electrical activity. Okay, you have a high density of metabolism. And then the other thing you need is that it's at some level of localized blood flow. Okay, because remember, we're looking down from the top. Okay, this stuff is happening anywhere from like 500 microns to 700 microns below the top. Now you're about, depends exactly on the tissue, but you're anywhere between 3 and 5 e-fold scattering length down. So things are scattering very, very severely. But it turns out, like I said, there's a predominance of the blood of the major arteries, feeder arteries, and the veins going out to drive down and run radially. So very fortunately, the blood flow itself is staying localized, and all this conspires to allow you to use these techniques to infer the activation. Okay. So. When all is said and done, this is data from Ron, and what Ron did was he took this slice of somatosensory cortex and he went whoosh, whoosh, like this with a curved razor blade, and he stained it. He actually stained it for a molecule that's very dense in presynaptic terminals called cytochrome oxidase. It's the last step in respiration. And then he had a map, an optical map, and he kept these things aligned. You can see all the blood, you can see all the descending blood vessel holes go through. It provides a way to align things. And it's not bad, right? And basically what this allows you to do then is make these kinds of maps, which at least this is a map of spatial location, right? But you could also imagine then you could have broken this down into further details if you had, you know, say move things at one orientation versus another. So this is the notion of mapping, and the idea is very old, and it comes from multiple penetrations with electrodes. But it's I think today the modern, in modern practice, it all gets back to these three inferences. Okay, so let me just go on a little bit. People have used these signals for various things. There's the last thing I just want to point out is that I've talked about mapping in space. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about mapping in features. Okay, so I'm jumping over lots of stuff. You talk to two people who do this thing. You know, it's like the joke of two Jews on an island and four synagogues. I mean, you talk to two people who use a technique, you'll get like four arguments or something. But let me just sketch a little bit what's happening. Okay. So I think what you see in many of the papers, and what you see in and what Fred will probably bring up tomorrow, is this idea of global signals and mapping signals. It's almost a kind of trivial idea. So let me just go back to this. So again, like I said, this is the spectra of oxy versus deoxy heme. It's just plotted here on a linear scale. And again, we're sitting, even though the maximum absorptions, absolute absorptions are sitting here, sort of in the blue, the green. Okay, the greatest contrast sits here, right, of oxy versus deoxy, sort of in the red. And okay, ignore this. Okay, but this is what happens, right? You do an experiment where you put, say, a visual stimulus on. So you have this poor monkey, right, or rat, or cat, right, and if you're interested in the eyes, use a cat or a monkey. If you're interested in the hairs, use a rodent. It's a real simple, it's a very simple rule, okay? So you've popped the top off the entire visual area, which, as Larry said, is in the back of the head. And you're looking down, and then you put a visual stimulus almost anywhere in the field, and you find out that to some extent, okay, that you get electrical activation throughout the entire visual cortex, and you'll get a reflectance change throughout the entire visual cortex. And I think you saw that already if you remember when Sebastian showed you movies from the original Hubel and Wiesel data. They had bars moving all around the field and hear okay, so again, the receptive field is a little bit of a loose idea, Okay, so you get activation everywhere. So if I could go to the center of the activity, right? And I could say that's where I'm most likely to respond. That's the receptive field. So that would say B, if I say B here. But one of the problems is if I have a bar like this, I hit right, and then I want to put a bar like this on, right? So I'm interested now in going beyond the spatial location and in mapping feature selectivity. All right, so I need to make a map everywhere in space, which I move this bar like this. You know the way these experiments are done, sort of rastering in a little window, right? I need to do another experiment. I need to raster in the other direction. I need to raster in the other direction in a little window. And what I want to report then is the selectivity to orientation. So I want to take all the guys like this and subtract off all the guys like this. So it's a difference map. Okay. So this is called a mapping signal, and it's relatively weaker. So let me see if I could just show you this. Okay. So this comes from Toby Bonhoeffer's work, but what he did was, I can just show one of these, is that this is reflectance map, and if we look, let's just look at one of these, that's all that's really important, is that if we look at a given spot, we saw a certain amplitude at this particular spatial location, or certain reflectance at this spatial location, when I had vertical stimuli moving, and a somewhat different reflectance when I had horizontal stimuli moving, right? So the extent of activation is not so different between vertical and horizontal. Okay, it's maybe not so surprising. I mean, we focus on cells, you know, the fun stuff is cells that have feature selectivity. But there are pathways, the W pathway, most of your visual cells, right, are not particularly responsive to orientation. Okay, so in fact, if I take all the data, the map I had made with the horizontal guys, and subtract from it the map I have with the vertical guys, okay, I get a difference. Okay, the difference again is substantial, but smaller than either of the individual traces. And so I do one versus the other. So now I'm down to and you make a map that looks like this. Okay, which has to be candy colored. So different colors represent orientation. So this is a place where preferentially the neurons are activated, okay, by bars that are horizontal. Preferentially, but not exclusively. And preferentially, this is a place where neurons are activated by bars that are vertical. Preferentially, but not absolutely. And also, as we'll be discussed heavily tomorrow, I mean, think of what you're doing. You have two dimensions. You have X and Y, and now orientation, right? So we're trying to take three dimensions and pack it down to two, right? It's, something has to crack. Okay, so again, not surprising you find these cracks or vortices or pinwheels, whatever you want to call them, okay, where effectively it looks like all the orientations are becoming present at a point. Now, it's kind of interesting here because in these kinds of measurements, you don't know if at that center of the crack you just lost information about orientation, so no single neuron is coding orientation, or if in fact every neuron is coding orientation strongly, but neighboring cells are coding different orientations. Okay, so there was a follow-up to this experiment. Again, it came out of Charlie Gray and Tobias Bonhoeffer, where they actually went in with an electrode. So they used this then as a map for where to place the electrodes. I think they really used this to maximal benefit. And they just went down the centers of these vortices, and they found out that every time they hit a neuron, it had a very strong orientation preference, but that orientation preference was shifting very rapidly. So on the scale of the optical resolution, which is a few hundred microns, far coarser than these boundaries would actually let you believe. Okay, you in fact had all orientations that are present. Okay, so this I think is this is basically the gist. Okay, of what happens in map making with intrinsic imaging. Okay, now that My personal bias is to try to use this to get an underlying neural dynamics is, I don't know, not the smartest thing. But for map making, it's been a phenomenal tool. And particularly from the fact that you could go back to the same animal over and over again. So there's bodies of work, there's just not time to present, from many laboratories where people tried to use these to study like the development of ocular dominance, right? You could thin the bone, or you could replace the bone with a piece of plastic and look through as a function of time. So it gives you a repeatability that you never had in the past when you just injected a dye and then, you know, dropped your animal in liquid nitrogen and sliced it up. Okay. Okay, so I think in the last 10 minutes I'll do all of nonlinear imaging. Okay. At a nonlinear rate. Now let's see if I was actually smart enough to okay, I think everything I've talked about so far sort of defines the sort of technology which has been involved in either data that was taken, what people presented, okay, or will use tomorrow. With one exception, I talked early on about an experiment looking at calcium diffusion in spines, and this was an experiment done in Winfried Denk's lab. And the experiment really needed resolution that was small on the scale of spines. You really needed to be close to the sort of submicron diffraction resolution. So I just want to sketch this because I started out this today by talking a little bit about where things are going. And I think you might have gotten the idea that Britton Chance is in a biochemistry department. He was trained as a physicist. fMRI, which is one of the things that Rick will talk about this afternoon with Seiji Ogawa. He was in the physics department of the former AT&T. It's like former Soviet Union or something, right? Larry Cohn sees an equation and he runs off in the other direction. But nonetheless, all these laser scanning techniques, Marvin Minsky held the patent, but the real substantive work done on building useful confocal microscopes was done by Amos at the MRC in England, and he's trained as a physicist. Winfried Denk is very, very well trained as a physicist. So Roger Chen was actually an undergraduate physics major. So you could just kind of see that you know, it's like cockroaches, physicists are kind of taking over some of the instrumentation. Okay. So back in the 1930s, Maria Mayer, of which the physics department building at UCSD is named after her, okay, did a calculation where she looked at the absorption of two quanta of light. Okay, quanta of light. Okay, and the cross-section is very, very small. I mean, basically, just out in sunlight, we might get one or two transitions within the known lifetime of the universe. It's not a very productive technique for thesis work. But when lasers were invented came up in the late 50s, about 1960, people had sufficient intensities, right? Because the transitions, now you had transition probabilities that went now like the square of the power instead of the power, right? People started measuring two photon cross sections. They started doing nonlinear dynamics and nonlinear properties of materials, right? And in sort of about 1980 or so, Chris Shank invented this thing called the colliding pulse laser, and this was a laser in which you had modest average powers, you know, watts, right? Watts. That's, you know, most of your crystals start to melt at 10 watts, but in fact, that power was in very tiny bunches. It was, you know, sort of in 100 femtosecond bunches. So you had power densities that exceeded, you know, like about 10 to the 14 watts per centimeter squared. It sounds enormous, okay, but the average powers was still around a watt, and this all of a sudden made the idea of using the absorption by multiple quanta quite feasible. And it was, and it's actually worth understanding why a little bit. Okay, so just need to grab a view graph a second. This is kind of the issue. Let me try to sketch this briefly. you have this problem in biology, this basic problem. You want to look deep, okay? As you're looking deep, there's all this stuff, right? You're focusing from your lens deep, right? But you have all these scattering centers, and you're losing light due to all these scattering centers, right? And then the problem is you're imaging either from below or you're imaging back from above in reflectance, and you still have scattering centers, right? And you're just constantly defocusing your image, right? So people play various games. They'll take images at different depths, and they'll deconvolute. And each of these games has their own problem because, you know, you have only so much light you could put in before you destroy your tissue, right? So only a small fraction of your tissue contains information. You're trying to throw away background. So ultimately, all these effects begin to catch up with you. Now, part of the absorption with fluorophores is that if you just have a normal fluorophore, the probability of absorption just goes like the power, right? So obviously it goes like the intensity, okay? And so it's greatest right at the focus, right? But you're also getting absorption to a lesser extent in these outer focus regions of the beam, okay? Now suppose I scan. So what I do is I have my laser light coming in, and I'm interested in what's happening within this section, right? Because this is this cortical column that I want to study. So I'm scanning my beam across. I know where the beam is because I'm moving the mirrors, and I have a record of where I'm moving the mirrors. And I'm scanning the beam across, and I'm illuminating here, and I'm illuminating here, and I'm illuminating here. So that's great. So let's see what happens. I move the beam over a little bit, and I illuminate this section. Then I move the beam over a little bit, and I illuminate this section. Okay, but this guy is just being illuminated the whole time. So all this out of focus stuff is being illuminated. And in fact, by the time I finish scanning this area, right, I've driven as many transitions in this out of focus region as in the focal plane. And I think this is shown here. So this is actually data. Can you get the lights? This is data that you can't see it. It's so good you can't see it. Right? From Watt Webb's lab. And what they did was they took polymethyl methacrylate, which is the stuff plexiglass is made of, and filled it with rhodamine. And then they scanned it, okay? And they scanned a line. They went back and forth on this line, okay, at relatively high power, and then just made an optical section throughout the entire sample, right? And just don't worry about how that's done. But what you've seen is that all the dye in this whole region has been bleached out. Because not only did they drive transitions where the focus was, but as sort of I described, they drove transitions above and below. All right? So it's true, the power in these out of focus regions fell off, like, you know, went over the area I was scanning, but then the time I scanned went like the area. So the power up here integrated over time is the same as the power here. Okay, now I think the idea was to then have a somewhat different transition, something that goes as the square of the intensity, right? So by the time I go up to this out of focus region, things the power, okay, has fallen off by one over the area. So that means that the chance of my driving the transition has fallen off by one over the area squared, okay? And it's true the time I spend here scales as the area. Okay, but that just still leaves me a transition probability that falls off like one over the area I've scanned. Okay, so we do this somewhat rigorously. You find out that you get integrably only absorptions at the focus. Okay, so I think this was a very clever idea. It was so clever, I'm jealous. And because of this, what you could do is you could come in with light, and you could be shedding all sorts of light due to scattering, but you're not driving transitions above or below. You're only driving transitions at the focus point, and has two major effects, okay? One is that you're not bleaching the sample. So if you have a dye everywhere, you're not bleaching the dye out at this part. The second thing is tissue itself has some background absorption, okay? And due to molecules involved in the electron transfer chain, and like the flavins or NADPH, and these absorb up to about 700 nanometers. So you're not bleaching them out or destroying them. And the third thing is that, you know, you only get transitions right at this spot, right? So wherever you shine light in, right, wherever you're focused at, wherever the light's coming in, that's where you're driving transitions. So then I look at the fluorescent light coming out of here, right? So I've lost a lot of light coming in. Okay, and then there's light coming out. Okay, so if it's fluorescence, the light's a slightly different color. So this light comes out. Now, in the ideal world, right, it would come out in every direction, and some of it would just get refocused. But suppose all this light, let's take the extreme case, is scattered. All the fluorescent light is scattered. I don't really care, because what I could do is I could just wrap this whole thing in a detector. Okay, and I can know that any fluorescent light that gets out had to be light that was generated from the spot. Okay, so basically this constitutes a mechanism for optical sectioning. Okay, so once that's all said and done, what we need only is to show a couple of examples. So I'll just show I'll show two. Okay, we've seen lots of pictures of single cells. This is a single cell which sort of lost it. There's an electrode that's coming in. We're looking down from the top. Okay, there's an electrode coming in from the side that's filled the cell with dye. So this is actually this is work with Winfried and Svoboda and Tank. And sort of before we talked about imaging whole animals looking at large areas, but in fact if we go in with an electrode, so we still have to fill a single cell with a dye. Right, I mean, this is this long dream to try to get this to be done transgenically, but still a dream. But once you fill this, you can use this kind of optical sectioning technique just to scan up and down. And at the end of the day, you reconstruct a picture of the cell. And this is in the living animal. Okay. Now, there's a number of dyes, and we talked about voltage probes being sensitive to calcium concentration. I mean, to voltage probes having spectral shift. There's a series of dyes. These are really sort of the modern era, like I said, is due to Roger Chen. And these dyes operate by a number of mechanisms. One is which these are chelating molecules, right? These are the things you learned about in inorganic chemistry and really hated. Like they had like four nitrogens on them, and then, you know, a calcium came in and gets stuck in place. And in this particular case, the binding of a calcium affects the lifetime of the fluorescence. Okay, and what the consequence is that is that the amplitude of the fluorescence actually shifts depending what the local calcium concentration is. So, if to the extent that you have, like we talked about in synapses, that every time an action potential comes in, it causes an influx of calcium. This becomes a contrast mechanism to look at that influx of calcium just by looking at the amplitude of fluorescence. Okay, so that's become quite an industry, and the only point just to make here, let me just try to get this. So in these kind of experiments, okay, which are still somewhat brute force to the extent that you have to load individual cells with the dye, you could have a living animal. You could be looking at a single cell, and this is an electrode. It's actually in the soma, which is here. It's totally lost, and this is the apical dendrite going up, and this is the basal dendrite going down. And what we're doing is we're looking at the amplitude of input to the cell when we wiggle a whisker, okay, and we're looking at actually the amplitude of the calcium signal. So the calcium signal, the bigger the depolarization, the more probability of opening these calcium channels, and the larger the signal, and it just falls off as you go away from the soma. It's not the most exciting data in this particular example. Okay, but this technique is very nice. People asked about back propagating spikes during the break. This has been a very nice way to look at action potentials going back into the dendrite. Fritjof Helfgen has had very nice data in this direction. People have used this for all sorts of developmental issues. We do have transgenic animals that produce green fluorescent protein that fill the whole cell. So you could look at spines that fill with actin. Actin is constantly polymerizing and depolymerizing. You could look at all these wiggles go on in time and how they modify with activity. In my own lab, in work that the people are not here, Phil Stein and Nozomi Nishimura, looking at actually could look at blood flow. So these kind of signals that contributed to the intrinsic signal, in fact, we could look at the level of capillaries. But so just to put in perspective, so I just tried to, this morning, this is kind of a WYSIWYG tour of neuroscience. So we talked about voltage measurements and sort of how they influenced modern neuroscience. It was really the voltage clamp, was this, the advent of feedback control that really allowed people to understand channel properties. And these got a tremendous hit with the invention of the patch electrode and looking at single currents, which before this time were only inferred by noise. We talked about various optical contrast mechanisms, some for voltage, some for calcium. We talked about the use of nonlinear optics as ways to actually look at activity at depth. And we talked in words a little bit about the growth of genetics. I think these two areas are just going to fuse more and more strongly. We talked a little bit about indirect indicators, looking at metabolism, or in particular about oxygen, spectra of oxygen, using internal metabolites. And then I think what's sort of very, very exciting now, because when those experiments on people and on monkeys, basically mammals you could train, is Rick will talk this afternoon about using magnetic resonance imaging, okay, sort of aperture-dependent imaging, okay, to look deep into the brain. Okay, so let's meet here at 2 o'clock, or maybe just a little bit before 2, so we could start at 2 o'clock. Okay, thanks.